You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio William Guymer, who is an author, a peace activist, a veteran of the U.S. 82nd Airborne Division, and a professor of law emeritus at Washington and Lee University. After resigning his commission in opposition to the war on Vietnam, he represented conscientious objectors and advised peace groups near Fort Bragg, North Carolina. A Canadian citizen, he lives with his wife near Victoria, British Columbia, where he is a member of the Vancouver Island Peace and Disarmament Network. He's the author of Canada, The Case for Staying Out of Other People's Wars, which I highly recommend, and he serves as advisor on policy issues of peace and war to Elizabeth May, member of Parliament and leader of the Green Party of Canada. Bill Guymer, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
It's great to be back, and it's great to hear that that the World Beyond War is going to have its conference in Canada this year. We are very pleased about that.
We are as well. We're looking forward to it and to having you speak there. Our annual conference will be September 21st and 22nd in Toronto, and people can go to worldbeyondwar.org and sign up. First of all, I need to ask you on behalf of President Donald Trump, are the Canadians at all sorry yet for having burned down the White House?
The expressions of regret are very few and far between, as far as I can tell. In this morning's newspaper, there still are a newspaper. On the other hand, there was a letter to the editor signed by six Americans apologizing for Mr. Trump.
Very good. I'm glad to hear it. I think given the number of times the United States has invaded Canada and what kind of influence it's been on Canada, the apologies should perhaps weigh more that way than the other. What do you, in terms of what you plan on speaking about at our conference in September, Canadian war making, what do you think the world should most know about Canadian involvement in making war?
Well, there are implications for the U.S., of course, if it ever begins to lose allies in its post-World War II colonial effort to dominate the world with its 800 or so base, military bases and so forth. The U.S. can't do it alone, and I spent last year going around Canada preaching, for lack of a better word, that Canada could and should get free, begin to get free of the U.S. militarily, and that this was exactly the time to do it. And that message has really gotten stronger given what's happened this year. And so I'll be talking briefly about how the story of Canada's involvement in wars that are directed certainly in the last few decades by the U.S. Are absolutely not Canada's responsibility. It's clearly somebody else's war, and some idea of how we might begin to take steps to get free. And that's what actually started me. I'm giving a talk now on a subject that that is not front page news. It's not the all Trump all the time, and it's not even about wars. But it's about another aspect of the U.S. Effort to draw Canada and other countries into assisting it in its quest for domination, and that is the perversion of peacekeeping. It's a matter that is more on the hearts of and minds of Canadians than U.S., for sure. And it is in danger of being co-opted by the U.S. Happy to talk about any aspect of that.
Yeah, let's back up and give people an overview, because I'm sure I'm going to agree with you that it is a perverse project. I'm not sure I'm going to agree with you that there's such a thing as unperverted peacekeeping. So tell us what that would be. What is the pure unperverted form?
I know that we have a respectful we are not 100% ad item on all of this, and I do respect that. And in fact, I want to point out that I strongly endorse nonviolent humanitarian interventions in conflict zones, and I point my audiences to sources that show that it really works better than peacekeeping with a military component.
Right.
But I'm dealing with the world the way it is today, and with an existential threat that Canadians will once again be deceived by the U.S. according to a formula that has been established in the past, and drawn into combat, all the while thinking that they're going to peacekeeping. And so I am outlining a vision for humanitarian peacekeeping with a military component. I have serious doubts as to whether my requirements for such a peacekeeping venture will be met, and that could therefore recommend that Canada sign on to such a mission. But I am absolutely certain that the upcoming supposed return to peacekeeping by Canada with a small mission to Mali is not peacekeeping. It is war making by another name, and Canadians are being drawn into it with exactly the same formula that was used to draw them into combat in Afghanistan, for example,
right.
and in other instances. So fair enough that you raised that early, because I do understand I don't believe you see a way for peacekeeping to be done with a military component at all, but that's what's on the table, and people ought to know that whatever's on the table today, whatever it is, it ain't peacekeeping.
I agree with that. Canada is out of Afghanistan at this point, right?
The U.S. said that it was okay to leave a couple of years ago. If they need us again, I'm sure that we will we'll go back. But it was and it's funny that Afghan people here say, "Well, we went to war in Afghanistan. What's that got to do with peacekeeping?" Well, we were lured into Afghanistan, being told that we were there to do peacekeeping work. Humanitarian assistance, and in the words of the Prime Minister then, we certainly don't want to get in any fights there. But so step one of the formula for getting us in is to appeal to who we Canadians think we are. We think we're humanitarian, peace-loving people. The second step then involves the tremendous integration of the Canadian upper military hierarchy with the U.S., generals, and there, this time by outright deceit in Afghanistan, the generals persuaded the government to move us from something that had some at least semblance of peacekeeping in Kabul to being one of only two U.S. allies to do actual combat in Afghanistan, so that the U.S. could be free for its illegal war on Iraq. So the military influence is step two. Step three is to justify what's being done with propaganda. And in Canada, for the most part, the theme was we were in Afghanistan to help women and build schools and so that little girls could go to school. And in fact, we have a beautiful Afghanistan memorial here in Victoria that shows just that, a soldier with a little girl holding his hands and walking away to school. Unfortunately, that's very nice, but it's not the truth. So that's the three-part formula that doesn't make any use of Canada's contribution, very real contribution to peacekeeping in the past, and simply moves us toward becoming a U.S. ally in a civil war, and that's exactly what's happening in Mali.
And what if Canada had said to the United States and NATO, we would be glad to send people to do humanitarian aid work and school construction and education in Afghanistan. In fact, we'll send people armed and trained and prepared with construction tools and teaching degrees and humanitarian aid expertise. And if you want people who've been trained and armed and bringing weapons of mass death and destruction, well, then you'll have to come back and ask for those. That's a different kind of people to ask. You know, in other words, why send soldiers taught to do nothing but kill and armed with guns to go and do aid work and build schools? It doesn't seem to make much sense to me.
Well, it didn't. That's because it doesn't make any sense. But in answer to the question, that would entirely depend upon what the U.S. saw as its interest. And they've been very clear and very open about that. And there have been times, and there will be times, when they may make just such a request. But in Afghanistan, they very much wanted to free up their troops to go make war in Iraq. So and in fact, the Canadian defense minister at one point was very open about it. He said, we didn't send troops to Iraq. We didn't sign on to the anti-ballistic missile thing. There's only so many times we can say no to the U.S. Right now, the only flag we have to wave is Afghanistan. We're offside on everything else. We have to do what the U.S. asks. Now, I'm not a raging nationalist, but that's embarrassing, I think, for a sovereign country to say, well, you know, we've told them, we can't tell them no another time. We have to send people to die in Afghanistan, and we have to send them under a false flag.
Yeah. We're speaking with William Geimer, whose books include Canada, The Case for Staying Out of Other People's Wars. So you started to talk about the case of Mali, and you used the phrase existential threat. Was that because Canadians believe Mali is going to destroy Canada? Or?
No, not the threat of Mali. The threat is that the U.S. will use this very same formula that I've outlined to pervert the language of peacekeeping. For example, I heard the parliamentary secretary to the defense minister, when asked about peacekeeping, the example he pointed to was advisors to the Iraqi military in that conflict, and he called them warrior diplomats. So this is the beginning. This is step one of the formula, and that is appealing to who we think we are, and the commitment in Mali, that's the existential threat, that once again we're going to start out small, as we always do. This commitment is relatively small in military terms, and it's going to be under the guise of doing good things, and then it's going to be basically intervention in a civil war on behalf of the side that the U.S. has chosen through its chain of command. And I did want to mention that what becomes apparent in this, and even more apparent in Mali, but in all these things, is the chain of command goes this way. At the top is the U.S. NATO is the military arm of the U.S., and the Western nations dominated by the U.S. Make up that anachronism known as the Security Council of the United Nations. So if the U.S. decides that there ought to be intervention on one side of a civil war, then Security Council authorizes peacekeeping, in this case, by uses that name, and opens the door to anyone that wants to help enforce some sort of an agreement. And NATO steps up and says, we'll do it. And Canada's a member of NATO. And the next thing you know, the formula is underway.
Yeah. Canada is a member of NATO. It's not signed the new nuclear new treaty banning possession of nuclear weapons.
No, we have a very interesting campaign going on that. I'm glad you mentioned it because we're very aware, many of us here, of the history and the reluctance to sign on to this very important treaty. And so there's a campaign underway that if Canada won't sign it now, and many people think Canada will come around and sign, many people in my orbit, I don't know about that, but there is a campaign on to have people sign the treaty. We actually bring around a copy of the treaty, and at groups, at gatherings, people are available to say, if the government won't sign the treaty, we will sign it symbolically ourselves. And so we've collected, I've been involved in that, we've collected thousands of signatures on this treaty to demonstrate that Canadians support it, whether the government does or not.
Yeah. Hopefully with the end result of getting the government to support it.
Yes, exactly.
It seems like Canada is... I'm not sure about this. This just occurs to me, but it seems that if you look at the size of Canada in relation to the world in terms of dealing weaponry to other countries and in terms of spending its own money on militarism, buying U.S. weapons and others, it's probably more involved in militarism compared to how many wars it's actually involved in than any other country. I mean, that is, countries like the United States spend a lot more, but they got 8-9 wars going at any time. You know, Canada's got a few soldiers in Mali, but it's spending $20 billion preparing for wars every year. It seems like that can't hold.
I certainly hope that it won't hold, and it's very true. The phrase here in Canada is punching above your weight, and sadly, Canada punches above its weight when it comes to being an arms merchant, and having plans for an escalating military. Our military budget is minuscule compared to the obscenity that prevails in the United States right now. But it is, proportionally, it is way too much and going up. And meanwhile, the biggest threat to the planet, the environment, that money has stayed flat in the Canadian budget. But I'm not really sure why we are. It's really just indifference and not being informed, I think, because... And the same can be said, obviously, of the U.S. I mean, you have this massive, bloated military that's costing people money, and people are scraping around for basic necessities. In both of our countries, school teachers are using their own funds to go out and buy basic materials, while the war material just continues. And I'm not sure about that, why Canadians can't see that. It's probably some of the same reason that we export raw materials rather than finish them.
Yeah.
So I really don't have an answer for that, except that maybe we've just been aligned with the U.S. for so long, we just have that blind U.S. mindset about defense budgets and weaponry.
Well, I mean, we don't call it defense, although people in Washington, D.C. do.
Definitely. It hasn't been that long since it was called the War Department, and it should be called that.
Yeah, 1947. As you note, the United States is off the charts worse than anywhere else in terms of weapons dealing and military spending. But we do have activist movements in the United States that focus on the budget, that get cities and the U.S. Conference of Mayors every year and some states to tell Congress to take the money out of militarism and put it into useful things. They never listen. Is that a focus of activism in Canada?
Well, it is certainly a focus in activism, and I think to be fair to us, maybe, I think, because I've been Canadian for many years now, you have the excesses of the United States may well be one of the factors that mobilizes people more. Here in Canada, people are not even aware of the extent of our involvement in in violence and war making, and there's a whole myth of how we are polite, well-meaning. You know, we're just concerned about, you know, the next hockey round of playoffs and stuff like that. And so it's a hard thing to get through. But as I traveled last year with the book and continue to work this year, and I'm still traveling, this, not as much, I really am impressed by the dedication of the peace movement here. It is growing. It's one of the reasons I'm enthusiastic of and grateful for the conference in Toronto. And not all of us have gray hair like I do. We have, in my group, Vancouver Island Peace and Disarmament Network, we have some absolutely fantastic young people. And so I think that perversely, I hate to use that word again, as the U.S. continues to go more and more off the rails, that we will be better able to alert Canadians to what is happening.
I certainly hope so. It would be good to have some silver linings to all our disasters. What about, I mean, it's not just war making, but weapons dealing. Are there efforts in Canada to stop the foreign arms trade and to divest money from profiting from arms dealing?
Not really to speak of, to tell you the truth. And I think it is a matter of priorities. Within the peace movement here, the nuclear threat is a very, very big item, and you can't argue with that, because if that goes off the rail by accident or misadventure or mentally challenged people, then all the other issues are off the table. The matter of involvement in other people's wars, I'm happy to say, is beginning to be something that folks are taking account of. But where the weapons trade might come in as a priority somewhere, still important, but down the line, if Canadians are concerned about anything, broadly, it is environment. We are losing, we're losing the most beautiful place on earth.
Yeah.
We in Canada are not doing nearly enough, but we're doing something. And south of the border, they're just ignoring it.
In the United States, people who are engaged and active think of environmentalism and the peace movement as two separate issues unrelated to each other.
They absolutely are not. A good colleague of mine, as a scholar, a young woman, brilliant young woman, Tamara Lawrence, who will be on the panel with me at the conference,
indeed,
has pointed out the relationship between militarism and the environment. And I don't know what else she's doing besides this panel, the first thing. But whatever she's doing, go listen to her. She's brilliant, and she's got the evidence that we cannot solve, really make a dent in the environmental issue unless we link it with militarism.
Well, it's where the money's going, and at least by numerous measures in the United States, the militarism is the single biggest destroyer of the environment. So it's not just that we're losing the money to that item in the budget. It's that it's anti-environmental. It's the biggest destroyer of earth, water, air, climate. Yeah. It seems that Canada needs a major environmental movement, has great environmental groups. I'm just not clear that they recognize the problem of militarism much more than in the United States, where it's
just... They don't yet, but we're working on it.
Yeah.
But really, with people like Tamara, we're really working on it. She opened my eyes with not just budget things, but with... for example, the Canadian military is exempt from environmental laws.
Yeah.
They can, as is the
U.S.
They can and do pollute all they want to. And Canadians don't know that. So it's our job, painful as it is, to try day by day to make them know that.
Some Canadians know it, and some Canadian Indigenous nations know it. We're going to have some speakers at the conference as well on the cruelty of the Canadian government towards Indigenous nations, which seems to know no bounds and no end.
I'm really glad that that is a part of the conference, because it's a growing that awareness is spinning off. First, it's a matter of basic justice to begin with, but it's also giving us, not only reconciling with the European folks, but also giving us allies to work together on a number of issues. I'm extremely grateful for that, because in my next writing project, I'm looking into my First Nations ancestor, who was the last chief of the Choctaws east of Mississippi.
Very interesting. We will look forward to reading that book and talking about it. It seems sort of selfish in the United States, the heart of militarism in the world, to be asking other people to do things. But it would be great if the Canadians could drag the United States in the right direction. I mean, the Canadians have done great things on landmines and other weapons. If Canada were to join the Treaty on Nuclear Weapons or otherwise take steps toward peace, how can peace activists in Canada and the United States work together to accomplish
more? Well, one of the things, and I'm looking for. Actually, I've been looking over the program, and I think that's going to be taken up, and I'm very much interested in that. I do think that it will be a shock if Canada. It will be a shock to the U.S. if Canada takes any meaningful step to disassociate itself. I have a plan, for example, a proposal that I will probably put forward at the Green Party convention for not just issuing a statement that Canada needs to get out of NATO, but convening a meeting of NATO under Article 12 of the Charter and proposing, one, that NATO conform to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, two, that it commit to abandoning non-defensive wars, and that if those things are not done within X amount of time, Canada will then consider withdrawing from NATO. That's the way I look at a process. I want Canada out of NATO. NATO is, as I said, the military arm of the international military arm of the U.S., but I don't see much hope in just continuing to issue statements. I think we need to work out a plan, and I'm very much looking forward to learning in September how we might do things like that. And if we ever do something like that, the shock to the U.S. Will perhaps lead the U.S. to begin to listen, not just to Canada, but to the rest of the world. You know, there's some pretty decent ideas out there.
That's an excellent point. I wish we could go on another hour talking about some of them. We're running out of time. William Guymer, his book that I highly recommend to you is called Canada, The Case for Staying Out of Other People's Wars. Bill Guymer will be speaking at the World Beyond War Conference in September in Toronto. Learn more and sign up to attend at worldbeyondwar.org. Bill Guymer, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It's a great pleasure, David. I look forward to seeing you in September.
Me too. Thanks. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a new report finds a big Bill Gates-backed education initiative is a bust. The findings, writes the Washington Post's Valerie Strauss with some restraint, quote, revive questions about whether the country is well served when America's wealthiest citizens choose pet projects and fund them so generously that public institutions, policy, and money follow, even if those projects are not grounded in sound research, close quote. For most media, though, those questions need to be not so much revived as engaged in the first place. We'll talk about that with Wayne Au, editor at Rethinking Schools and professor at the University of Washington, Bothell. Also on the show, while elite media preach civility towards those enforcing cruel and hateful policies, they will also celebrate the 4th of July, marking the rather impolite act of establishing national independence through revolution. The truth is, this country has a rich tradition of radicalism and dissent, struggle in many ways being the thing that has pulled us forward. It matters very much that the White House is working to criminalize protest as more and more people feel moved to take part. We talked about that this time last year with Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, activist, attorney, and executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. We'll revisit that conversation today. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. According to the Washington Post, the new president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, quote, bears more than a passing political resemblance, close quote, to U.S. President Donald Trump. Sure, as Gregory Shupak writes for Affair.org, they're practically the same person. In the late 1970s, AMLO, as López Obrador is sometimes called, was taking on Mexico's state-run oil company, setting up protest camps outside its offices to force it to pay compensation to indigenous communities and campesinos whose lands it had polluted. Around the same time, Trump was settling a lawsuit with the Justice Department that accused the company he owned with his father of refusing to rent apartments because of race and color. And while, as mayor of Mexico City, López Obrador subsidized subway fares for senior citizens and single mothers, as president, Trump doled out close to $5 trillion in tax cuts, almost exclusively for the wealthy, including a corporate cut of $1.5 trillion that CEOs say they will keep rather than invest or use to increase wages. Thus, the editorial's not at all hallucinatory headline, Mexico's could-be president is a lot like Trump. The Post's analogy, Shupak writes, is not just dumb, but a pernicious instance of a kind of extreme centrism that views as dangerous radicalism any departure from the idea of two political parties funded by the same sources carrying out similar policies, including neoliberalism, austerity, mass surveillance, and U.S.-led war. It's only that sort of incredibly shallow analysis that gets you to the takeaway the Post suggests, that Mexicans who chose López Obrador are, just like Trump voters, quote, blowing up the status quo without a reliable sense of what will replace it. The result is likely to be more trouble on both sides of the border, close quote. And when Donald Trump rails against alleged immigrant gang members as animals, as he did a few weeks back, the slime factor is high, but the surprise, zero. But as Josmar Trujillo wrote recently for Fair.org, local news media, sometimes presented these days as a check on Trump and Trumpism, resort to the same strategy, playing fast and loose with the inflammatory term gang and deferring time and again to questionable police tactics. New York's Daily News ran an infamous feature in 2015, Gangs of New York and How Close You Live to Them, including a map purporting to show where gangs and crews operate based on data provided by the NYPD. It echoed a New York Times piece from the 1990s denoting whole neighborhoods criminal communities. Well, these days, the Daily News is editorializing in favor of a gang database kept by the NYPD that no one knows they're on and therefore can't challenge their inclusion in, and that has added people as young as 13. It's a solid investigative tool, the paper says. Community concerns are alarmism. Inclusion in these databases can have serious impacts: increased bail, harsher sentencing, erosion of the presumption of innocence, and increased chances of deportation. Lawyers and activists suspect database information is shared with federal agencies like ICE, and the loose protocols sometimes put people trying to avoid gangs on the deportation block. The Daily News walked back their editorial support for stop and frisk after the curtailment of that practice failed to yield the ravages of lawlessness and bloodshed the paper had predicted. But here, again, they're failing to ask some basic questions. How many people are in this gang database? The NYPD, and hence the news, say about 17,500 New Yorkers are listed. But a FOIA request by CUNY Law School's Babe Howell suggests over 42,000 names based on information that she got from the police department. How much crime is connected to gangs? Well, despite reporting lingering on every grisly detail of what gang violence happens, police records show gang-related crime in a city with record low crime rates amounting for 1.7% of overall crime. And that's any crime involving someone police call a gang member. Gang-motivated crime, crime done in the interests of a gang, according to the police, is at less than 0.1%. Who decides who's in a gang? Well, the police, of course. And their criteria include things like associating with suspected gang members, living in certain neighborhoods, having certain tattoos, and wearing certain colors. Is it a surprise that 99% of the people added to the list are non-white? Does amped-up policing reduce gang violence? Well, much research says no, but much media coverage doesn't even ask. Trujillo is one of many organizers pushing back against the database and the NYPD's gang sweeps, and the Daily News did publish an opinion piece that he wrote opposing the database. But that doesn't amount to critical balance when, despite the lives impacted, the news and many other papers around the country are so eager to throw their reporting and their editorial weight behind the police time and time again. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by FAIR, the Media Watch Group. A new report from the RAND Corporation concludes that the multi-million-dollar teacher evaluation project, championed and partially bankrolled by Bill Gates, did not increase teachers' effectiveness or improve students' academic performance, including the low-income minority students that were presented as the initiative's major beneficiaries. The Washington Post's Valerie Strauss, a generally critical assessor of what's called education philanthropy, covered this new report. But most corporate media appear uninterested in this challenge to a set of ideas about failing public schools and how to fix them that they themselves play a notable role in promoting. Our next guest has critically engaged the Gates Foundation's educational forays for years now. Wayne Au is professor at the University of Washington, Bothell campus, and interim dean for diversity and equity on campus. He's also editor at Rethinking Schools. He joins us now by phone from Seattle. Welcome back to Counterspin, Wayne Au.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's important to note that while the Gates Foundation underwrote a reported $215 million of this project, that was less than half. School districts supplied the rest. So we're not talking about an episode of perhaps naive corporate noblesse oblige, you know, troubling as that would be. But a lot of public resources were put into this use test scores to evaluate teachers project that many, many educators knew from the get-go was misdirected.
That's really unfortunate, but I think it makes sense if you look at things in the current context. The same thing happened with Common Core and Race to the Top as well. We have a situation where public school districts are totally strapped for cash. We have class sizes that are just exploding, teachers paying out of pocket for classroom resources. And so school districts are just really hurting for money. And what often happens is philanthropists like the Gates Foundation say, hey, we have this project. Would you partner with us on this? And we're investing this much money in doing this thing, but you need to come and give, you know, X amount of dollars to this project as well, to devote your resources. And it's sort of within this context of what I would actually characterize as austerity funding for public education that many districts agree to partner with these foundations because it looks like they're bringing money in. Unfortunately, what happens is that many of the districts end up finding that this was the case with Common Core as well, that the money coming in for these new programs actually paled in comparison to what it took to implement the programs or to cooperate with the research and with these different kinds of programs. And so in the end, it's one of those things where we end up having our public dollars, public tax dollars, just being essentially sucked away into this whole other enterprise. And which often, and this is the sad part of it, you know, even though there's this philanthropic money coming from like the Gates Foundation and this public money from the school districts, often either nonprofits or for-profit corporations that are like creating the data tools for these things, they're the ones who are actually getting this money and essentially making money off of this kind of research project.
Right. I mean, it seems as though it's ultimately, and if you scratch, you can see it, and they sometimes even admit to it. I mean, it's ultimately about privatization, isn't it? This gospel of the private sector and market forces being the right response to everything.
Oh, absolutely. And you get that from the Gates Foundation all the time. Gates is very clear. He's trying to create, and he said this before, market conditions and market forces where everybody's working to make money, but this will be in the best interest of kids and education. And like that's how he frames this whole entire agenda. For me, that's the greatest fallacy of this whole idea of researching teachers in the way that the Gates Foundation did, and unfortunately in concert with the school districts, is that we've known for decades from the research base that teachers, they're critically important in terms of how students learn things, how students experience classrooms. However, we also know that test scores are very limited measures of student performance, what students know, what students learn. Therefore, they are very minimal in terms of measuring what teachers teach. But here we have the Gates Foundation essentially pushing high-stakes standardized testing, which teachers have actually very little effect on. The research has shown us for a long time that if you take any standardized test score, a teacher actually influences somewhere between 18 to 25%, depending on the study you're looking at. Everything else is actually external factors. There's all this stuff outside of schools that account for 75% of a test score. And this is if you want to believe the test scores, right? So we're talking things like food security, housing security, access to adequate health care, dental care, livable wages for their parents. These are the things that actually impact test scores. But this is only if you're going after test scores as your main measure. And again, they're super limited. And honestly, they don't really measure what students learn, and therefore also don't really measure what teachers are teaching. And so here we have this massive investment of hundreds of millions of dollars underwritten by the Gates Foundation, these districts and politicians and policymakers investing in it on the public education side, really trying to go after something that we've known has been fake, and it's been a rabbit hole that we knew wouldn't increase student performance. We've known that for a long time.
Yeah, and all of those other factors like food security, like housing, that of course, if you think about it, have an impact on test scores. That to me makes the kind of making of props of black and brown kids and underserved kids especially cynical, you know, and suggesting that this kind of scheme is going to uplift them and help them in particular.
Oh, for sure. In a way, I really see this as a colonizing agenda in a sense, because essentially what we have are predominantly white, super wealthy, elite philanthropies like the Gates Foundation, putting these programs into mostly black and brown and working class communities, right? And it creates this dynamic where you essentially have sort of these rich missionaries saying, we know what's best for you and your kids. We're going to do these things. Meanwhile, it sort of treats these children, these black and brown children, as like experiments, mm-hmm. right? And so the power dynamics are really, really skewed. All at the same time that folks like Gates here in Washington State, he's very opposed to a more progressive tax structure. He's actively fought against efforts here in our state to improve our tax structure so that we could give more basic services to more people in the state. We have one of the most regressive tax structures. And so to me, there's a great irony, and maybe irony is the wrong word, but you can just see the problems with these super elite white corporate folks just saying, hey, we know it's best for you, these communities. And that's also illustrated by the fact that all these reforms, like, you know, Gates wasn't using these measures to study the teachers of his kids
right.
at the elite rich private schools in the Seattle area. None of these reforms are for his kids. These are reforms for everyone else's kids.
Right. Well, the Gates Foundation, like others, has a strategy. They make their own echo effect. And part of that, as you know, is funding education journalism. That's something else that you have, as one headline had it, tangled with Gates-funded education blogs. So there's an impact in the way these things are covered.
It's no mistake that mainstream media has basically not followed up on the failure of the Gates study and interventions into a teacher evaluation. Because, again, here in Seattle, the Seattle Times education reporting is partially funded by the Gates Foundation, like this focus on solutions, and there was a whole granting program around that. And when you talk to those reporters about what they're allowed to report on, they say, well, the Gates doesn't control us, but then I'll ask and follow up and say, well, you know, how come you're not reporting on this? Like, we know ethnic studies helps kids do better in school, particularly low-income Black and brown kids. And they'll say, well, it's complicated. And so it's clear that there's this agenda that happens that the Gates Foundation is willing to fund. We used to see with Education Nation and stuff every fall, too, on NBC or whatever, and that would promote this particular agenda, and at the same time, unwilling to promote things that don't align with that agenda. And we see the same thing in educational research as well. So it's not just these major philanthropies impacting the reporting. They're also impacting what kind of research gets done, because they have their own whole funding machine that funds particular kinds of research. And so they were funding research on teacher evaluation. And then in turn, everyone who's chasing after grants starts trying to build their agendas around that so they can get the Gates money. But the Gates only funds stuff that falls in line with standardized testing and everything else that's part of their sort of neoliberal choice market agenda.
Well, and another frustration from the media perspective is that all of those sources who pointed out the flaws in this teacher evaluation agenda from the beginning and who were able to say quite clearly what the problems were, those sources, and now, you know, RAND is coming along essentially certifying that point of view, those sources are still not going to be the ones who get to weigh in when the next big money idea for education comes along, even though their concerns have borne out in this case.
Oh, yeah. No one ever talks to teachers. No one ever talks to parents. None of these big philanthropies go to communities to engage with them, really. They like to pretend they are, and they say, well, look, we're working with this nonprofit or this nonprofit, right? But all that is also a little bit fuzzy and a little shady, because many of the nonprofits that they use are also themselves funded by the Gates Foundation and are about promoting a particular agenda, versus there's social justice-minded community activists committed to public education, parent activists. These folks need to be brought into the conversation along with teachers, along with unions, frankly, as well. They should be involved in the decision-making, in the agenda setting, because, you know, we know what's wrong on the ground level. We know what's going on. And we know that all these major reforms, from small schools to even Common Core to the teacher evaluation stuff that Gates has been doing, those three major projects that they funded, they've been failing everywhere. And in part because they've been doing this massive anti-democratic top-down model of education reform. And they only pretend to talk to the folks down on the ground and instead really focus on, they believe they know what's right, and they're just going to work their power and their money to get that implemented until it doesn't work.
We've been speaking with Wayne Au, professor at the University of Washington, Bothell, where he is also interim dean for diversity and equity, and he's an editor at Rethinking Schools. Wayne Au, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Right on. Thanks for having me.
A Washington Post poll from July 2017 found that one out of every three Washington, D.C. residents said they'd taken part in a protest against Donald Trump since his inauguration. That number included half of the district's white residents, half of people making more than $100,000 a year, and a fifth of respondents over the age of 65. As more and more people go out in the street, states are rushing to criminalize that resistance. This time last year, we talked about the right to protest and the role of law in a time of widespread dissent with activist attorney Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. I started by asking about the J20, the group of people, including journalists, arrested for protesting at Trump's January 20th inauguration. Counterspin listeners got an update on the state of that case just a few weeks back on the show. Mara Verheiden-Hilliard explained the nature of the J-20 case.
This case is really of extraordinary proportions when you look at what the government is doing to people who are engaged in protest on the first day that Trump took office. And it's really, in its own context, significant, too, because of the major shift in policing in Washington, D.C., which we believe is intended to send a signal. What's happened now is more than 200 people were swept up in a dragnet arrest by the police. And this occurred after the police had followed a demonstration for, by their own account, approximately a half an hour, while there were some people who broke windows, only a handful of people. And rather than going in and arresting the people for whom they had probable cause to arrest, the police waited and at an arbitrary time trapped and detained 200 people. And so they swept up demonstrators, passersby, journalists, anyone who's in proximity, anyone who was chanting and protesting. And then they undertook this mass prosecution with the United States Attorney's Office here in the District of Columbia, in which people are being threatened with, as you've mentioned, jail time that is decades and decades long, really a lifetime of jail time with these felony charges. They are charging people en masse with crimes that may have happened in terms of property damage, but charging everyone with crimes without particularized probable cause, without being able to point to a person and say, you committed this act, and so we're charging you for this act. They're charging everyone in the vicinity for being in proximity. This is extremely dangerous. It sets the stage that for any demonstration, if anyone commits a criminal act, an act of property damage, whether that be a protester or, frankly, a police agent provocateur, the police can now use this as license, or they wish to sweep up everyone else around them.
Well, this is what we talked about before. It's not a crime now, is it, to be in proximity to other people who break the law in conjunction with First Amendment activities?
Of course it's not, and it cannot be. And the First Amendment has always stood for that, in fact, you cannot criminalize a person for the acts of another, and particularly in the context of the First Amendment, when it's an issue where the connection is that there may be a sympathy of political views, one cannot do that. There are cases dating back, NAACP v. Claiborne Hardware and others, the court said you have to act with precision. You cannot say that just because people have a similar point of view or may have similar political goals, that those who carry out illegal acts or acts of violence in pursuit of those goals, that those acts can be attributed to the others who do not.
Right. These charges at the level they're at, it feels new. But we know that the effort to repress First Amendment expression is not new. The Supreme Court last month rejected a First Amendment case that dates from years back, Garcia v. Bloomberg. Can you tell us about that and how it relates?
The Garcia v. Bloomberg case comes from the Occupy demonstration of 2011 when 700 people were peacefully marching, compliant with police orders. There was no violence, and as people marched, the police escorted the march. The police themselves closed the Brooklyn Bridge roadway to vehicular traffic. The police and police commanders themselves opened up the roadway to pedestrian traffic. It is the police and police commanders who led the demonstrators onto the roadway of the Brooklyn Bridge. And once those demonstrators had flowed and followed behind the lead of the police stopped the march, trapped them from behind, mass arrested 700 people. When we litigated this case, we won at the district court level. We won at the Second Circuit, in fact. And then Mayor de Blasio, who had taken office, frankly, running on an Occupy ticket, had the court reevaluate the ruling, and the court, in an extraordinary measure, reversed itself. And we took this case up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court just last month determined that they would not hear it.
Obviously, lots of folks are taking their lead from this and kind of joining on this bandwagon. We have a spate of anti-protest legislation around the country. Even UN experts are issuing alarmed statements now. Some 20 states have passed or tried to pass laws, allowing protesters to be charged with conspiracy, increasing penalties for blocking streets, even protecting drivers who run protesters over, banning masks and hoodies. I mean, is anyone really confused that the intent of these rules is to quash dissent? And doesn't that thinly veiled intent matter?
It's clear that there is an effort around the country to try and, through legal means, although we would consider them illegal means, curtail people's fundamental First Amendment rights to gather together in the streets, to be able to speak out in unified action. I do think, as much as we're seeing these kinds of restrictions imposed and these rulings, that at the same time it can obviously have a chilling effect on people. The reality is that people do always come out, and people will continue to come out. And while this may be intended to have a chilling effect, it is really crucial that people stand up and speak out for what they believe in. And I do think the reason that we're seeing these is because there is a growing recognition that there really is this fire of people, these embers burning, where we keep seeing people come up and demonstrating for what they believe in. We're seeing so many more people entering political life, even since the election of Donald Trump. People are taking the streets and protesting who never protested before. So while we're faced with what is, I think, overt repression, both in terms of these felony prosecutions, these state laws, these court rulings, we also are faced with the fact that there are millions of people who are engaging in political protest and political organizing who have never done so before. And that's a force that really can't be stopped.
We've been speaking with Mara Verheiden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Find them online at justiceonline.org. Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
That was Mara Verheiden-Hilliard talking with Counterspin in July of 2017. For an update on the J20 case, you can find Counterspin's interview with Sam Menefee-Leiby on FAIR.org. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, we'll talk about how creatures fell into extinction during abrupt climate shifts, sometimes within a single human lifetime. Paleoecologist Jacqueline Gill joins us.
About 1,000 years later was also very abrupt. So within less than a century, several degrees Celsius warming, which is what we're looking at in the next century today. And so these kinds of very quick events were very shocking to scientists a few decades ago when we first discovered just how quickly the climate system could shift like that.
But first, some of the most shocking science yet. From the Netherlands, Dr. Thomas Crowther speaks for a team of 50 world scientists, all warning the official climate projections are missing an important carbon feedback. As we warm, the soil will release carbon dioxide and methane equivalent to the greenhouse gas emissions of the whole United States.
We estimated that the carbon emissions from the soil are going to be approximately equivalent to 17% of current anthropogenic emissions. So every year, humans will emit a certain amount, and then the soil will be responsible for an extra 17%. Whereas at the moment, the U.S. is also 17% of the total anthropogenic emissions. So it's really just sort of on that same order of magnitude. Every year, the soils will emit about equivalent amounts of carbon that we expect to be emitted from the U.S.
Go ahead and deny it. Appoint all the climate deniers to the top levels of government. Command the rising tides to stop. And say it isn't happening. Nature and the geophysical reality of this planet does not care what you think. The atmosphere, the seas, and the soil are shifting to a new reality. That's the super tweet rocketing around the world, and all the president's men can't stop it. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
For a couple of decades, I've heard scientists worry that the warming world will speed up microorganisms that break down carbon. That could release more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But is it true? How can we test that? Scientists in different countries have been trying to simulate a warmer world to see what happens to plants and to the soil. Now a team of dozens of scientists have released a summary of those studies. It looks like added carbon from the soil alone adds a whole new need for us to cut human emissions quickly, and as Donald Trump would say, bigly. We've reached the lead author for this letter, published in the journal Nature with 49 other scientists. It was published on December 1st, 2016. Dr. Thomas Crowther has been a postdoctoral fellow funded by the Yale Climate and Energy Institute. Now he's at the Netherlands Institute of Ecology. He's an expert in soil organisms and extends his study to the processes of climate change. Thomas, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me on.
To get us started, how much carbon is stored in the soil relative to the amount of carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere?
So at the moment, the most recent estimate of global soil carbon stocks is about 880 petagrams. And that's just talking about the upper soil horizon, the very top 10 centimeters of soil. And those are the most sensitive to things like warming and changes in microbial activity. That's really the carbon that we're most interested in.
And a petagram is about a billion metric tons of carbon, is that right?
That's right, a billion metric tons or a trillion kilograms.
All right, now how long have scientists suspected that a warming planet might stimulate a carbon release from the soils?
So for a couple of decades now, we've theoretically supposed that it might be possible that increasing activity of organisms that live in the soil might stimulate the loss of carbon into the atmosphere. But at the same time, we've also had these considerations that maybe increases in plant growth might offset those changes. And so, you know, there would be as much carbon being lost as there is being taken up by the soil under warming. And so that's really why all these studies around the world have been established and been running for a long period of time to try and get an idea on the balance of those two processes.
Well, your team studied and summarized about 50 experiments on the impact of warming the ground. How can anyone test that, and where have those studies been done?
They're conducted all across the Northern Hemisphere. Really, it would be best if we had them in the Southern Hemisphere in the tropics as well, but those are the areas where there's not so much carbon in the soil, so we're not too worried about carbon losses in those regions. But these studies were conducted in individual sites all over the Northern Hemisphere, and they all had warmed plots next to ambient plots. And so you can really compare the amount of soil between those different plots. Other research has been done exploring the actual changes in fluxes to and from the soil. So that's the movement of carbon into and out of the soil. But those are very short-term, immediate-term readings, and they give us a very quick snapshot as to what's happening. And so they show very variable responses. But by looking at the long-term net changes in carbon pools across a huge region, global perspective, we can really get a broad perspective overview on the process and identify how the total global carbon pool is changing.
Well, now the group letter says initial carbon content can be the determining factor during warming. And we know that soils at high latitudes, including Arctic permafrost even, may be deep and contain vast amounts of carbon stored from previous ages. And that seems to say the Arctic will become a significant carbon source. And yet the letter in Nature, if I'm reading it right, says an archive of previous Earth system models predicted increased soil carbon at high latitudes. Thomas, which is it, more carbon loss in high latitudes or less?
Well, based on our study, at least in response to warming alone, we would expect to see losses from the Arctic. Earth system models, though, take into account a range of different processes. And one of the major processes that they take into account is increased plant growth in response to elevated CO2. And this leads to sort of a greening of the Arctic. And so all of those Earth system models that have been used for the climate projections, they've incorporated that increased plant growth, which has meant that they expect there to be increased photosynthesis in the Arctic and then increased carbon uptake and then storage in the soil. But the problem was, we've also had these concerns about this soil carbon feedback, but because it's been the data on this topic has been highly idiosyncratic, with thousands of studies showing increases and thousands showing decreases in soil carbon, ultimately the Earth system modelers in several of the models removed that feedback from the process. So they removed the soil carbon losses, leaving only the increased plant growth. That's why people expected there to be gains in the Arctic. So our study shows that it's absolutely critical that they put this soil carbon feedback back into those models. And we suggest that the losses of carbon from the Arctic, at least from the high latitude soils, has the potential to at least be on the same order of magnitude, if not offset those increases in plant growth.
Now, you talked about reactions in the top 10 centimeters or 4 inches of soil. But what if we included deeper soils? Could the carbon loss be greater than your conclusions?
Yes, certainly losses of carbon from deeper soil horizons has the potential to enhance the losses that we've seen here. And certainly in, you know, high permafrost regions, when you're getting melting of permafrost, that is going to have an impact deeper in the soil, and those are really going to potentially enhance the size of our feedback. The reason we focused on the top 10 centimeters is because this is the most biologically active area, and certainly that's going to be the largest contributor to these soil carbon losses. But if there's going to be any impact at all from the lower horizons, it's also going to be increasing the size of the process.
So will soil surface temperature change in lockstep with atmospheric temperature? In other words, if we have 2 degrees C increase in global mean temperature rise, does the soil go up 2 degrees C, or can it be more or less?
So soil temperature generally matches atmospheric temperature rises, which obviously follow atmospheric CO2 concentrations. So in short, yes. We expect to see gradual warming as we see gradual increases in CO2.
So what are the agents which you've studied which act to release carbon from the soil? Who are the characters we might meet if we had telescopic eyes?
The soil is home to tens of thousands of different species of, obviously there's plants, but there's also bacteria and fungi, the microbes that are hugely abundant in every single gram of soil. And there's also lots of animals like mites and things called calendula or springtails, and you know, worms and beetles and all sorts of stuff. The soil is absolutely teeming with a huge abundance of organisms. And really it's the microbes that we focus on because they're the greatest biomass. The biggest proportion of the biomass of the living organisms in the soil is the microbes. And so when they get warmer, their activity increases in the same way that, you know, human activity increases when we get warmer, leading to more respiration, leading to more carbon emissions from those microbes. But it certainly happens with plants and animals too. So just the more active all of these organisms are getting, the more they spew carbon out into the atmosphere.
Well, look, I'm a gardener, and I claim gardeners and farmers are the most interested part of the public who care about life in the soil. But our culture, Thomas, trains us to avoid things now like decomposition and smells and rotting, and I wonder if that adds to the general blindness we have for the importance of soil organisms. What do you think?
I think that's a very good point. I think soil organisms are absolutely critical to the functioning of our planet. You know, the breakdown of plant-derived carbon products is responsible for regulating atmospheric CO2 concentrations and regulating our climate. They're critical to the processing of nutrients and to the release of nutrients and to the growth of plants and productivity in agricultural systems. These organisms that are completely ignored by most of us are really the drivers of biogeochemical processes as well as food production and all sorts of other processes. So, yeah, I completely agree with you that it's these organisms that are sort of the unseen majority, and they really play a major role in our planet.
Well, now for a foolish question. I've almost burned my hand putting it into a compost pile where organisms are digesting plants rapidly. Could the added heat from microorganisms working faster add any significant heat to the planet beyond the carbon and methane they emit, or is that just silliness?
It's not silliness. I know what you mean. When you stick your hand in some decomposing material, you can certainly feel the heat. But if there is any additional heat being entered into the atmosphere, it's absolutely nothing in relation to the amount of warming that we get from the CO2 that's being emitted.
Okay. Now, do we know how much soil carbon may be released as carbon dioxide compared to methane? And would methane released from soils be significant?
Certainly, the carbon is likely to come out in the form of methane and carbon dioxide, but it'll be in the vast majority of places dominated by carbon dioxide, which is the largest greenhouse gas, but certainly not the most potent. Methane is many times more potent than carbon dioxide, but it's really in those high latitude areas where we're seeing the biggest losses that you actually get a larger proportion of methane buildup in the soil, in the frozen soil. So it's not necessarily a good news story, but it's difficult to say globally what the total proportions are at this moment. But that's obviously something that we're looking into at the moment.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with scientist Thomas Crowther. Let's talk a little bit about the limitations, as there are doubts about all scientific papers. First of all, I was confused to read that by 2050, global soil carbon stocks in the upper soil horizons will fall by 30 plus or minus 30 petagrams. Now, if I read that correctly, it seems to include a margin of error of 100%. Doesn't that imply this projection of increased carbon release could be wrong?
It certainly suggests that the value of 30 might be wrong. It is our most likely estimate, but still, there's a large uncertainty. But what I'd really stress is that uncertainty is not a concern here, because we're talking about processes that are going to drastically accelerate the rate of climate change. And so what this study categorically shows is that there will be this feedback. It will exist. And I sort of equate it to if you're planning to cross a road and, there's a bus coming at 50 miles an hour, there's no doctor on earth who can tell you exactly how many bones you're going to break. There's a huge uncertainty in his understanding of how damaged you're going to be. But we do know that there's going to be a significant damage to you, and therefore that should be enough information to encourage you to avoid moving buses in the future. And that's really what we're doing here. We show that undoubtedly there's going to be considerable losses. The magnitude of those losses varies hugely, but we can suggest that for sure that the losses are going to occur.
Indeed. Please step away from the bus. Well, this fall, I talked with Professor James Curran. He's formerly the head of the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency, and his paper suggests biomass is capturing less carbon dioxide, the plants, less carbon dioxide, as the climate becomes hotter. Is your projection for greenhouse gas emissions from soil affected by that if plants sequester less carbon from the soil?
Certainly, as any processes that dampen the carbon sequestration in plants are going to contribute to this kind of process in soil. Ultimately, plants are the main players that are responsible for taking carbon from the atmosphere and sticking it in the soil. So anything that damages that potential to take that carbon up ultimately limits the amount of carbon that's sequestered in the soil, yes.
Thomas, what about the impacts of precipitation changes like growing desertification in the subtropics or more rain in the Arctic? How does that affect this study?
So the impact of precipitation changes could drastically alter the effects that we observe here. that you're going to see extreme precipitation changes, that can really regulate the magnitude of losses. In our study, we're only really able to address the warming, and the value of that is we have a better perspective on how general that warming is going to be, and we know that that is the dominant process, by far the major process regulating carbon emissions from soil. But certainly changes in precipitation, which could be idiosyncratic, might alter the magnitude of this effect to some extent, and that's why it's processes like that that cause us to have so much uncertainty in that final prediction.
Now, to be clear, in this paper, when you discuss 1 degree C of warming over 35 years to 2050, are you assuming 1 degree above pre-industrial temperature of the planet or 1 degree hotter than we are now?
That would be 1 degree hotter than we are now. But that's not what we're predicting. That's the most sort of recent ensemble member of the Earth system model suggests that soil temperature, surface soil temperature is going to go up by 2 degrees by that time. So it's closer to an order of magnitude of 55 petagrams by 2050 will be lost from the carbon.
Can you please explain why the effects of a given amount of warming are never fully realized?
So ultimately, the process is always acting in response to warming. So the warming takes place, and then it's within the next couple of years that ultimately the total extent of carbon emissions takes place. So it's never an immediate process. And so it's almost like the changes in carbon emissions are always following the changes in warming.
Okay. So since more carbon from soils will increase warming, we call this a positive feedback loop. Are there control factors which can slow or halt this extra carbon release from the soil?
Certainly. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that changes to agricultural practices, things like holistic management of grazing animals or, you know, the use of biochar or organic products can lead to massive scale carbon sequestration. And this has the potential to dampen the feedback that we're talking about here. And, you know, if done on a global scale, I think it has a strong chance to put a major dent in the magnitude of these carbon losses.
As you know, many scientists worry that a hotter world will lead to mass extinctions of plants, animals, and other life forms that can't adapt to a rapidly changed environment. What about the world of microbiology? Thomas Crowther, is there a point at which heating causes damage or even mass death of critical microbial life?
That's definitely an important point, actually, because the reason we see the major losses occurring in the Arctic is because there is a limit on the extent to which microbes will continue to grow. I'll explain myself. Essentially, a microbe will continually get more and more active up to about 30 or 40 degrees. But beyond that 30 or 40 degree threshold, ultimately their enzymes start to denature and they start to struggle, and then they no longer emit as much carbon. And the reason we see such bigger changes in the Arctic than we do in the tropics is because the tropics are already close to that 30-degree mark. So when you warm an already warm microbe, you get no increases in carbon losses. But when you warm a microbe that's existing in the Arctic at 0 degrees, then there's immediately increases. And that will only continue to increase until the Arctic is 30 degrees. So at least within our timescale that we're thinking of on a climate change timescale, that we will hopefully never reach a time when warming doesn't stimulate microbial activity in the high-latitude regions of the world.
Okay. Now, next, your paper says, quote, "We stress that such statistical approaches cannot be used to project soil carbon losses far into the future." Why not?
Ultimately, we are predicting changes in a single pixel, each pixel of the Earth, based on a simple linear relationship. And this relationship is really good at predicting what's happening now. But when you project it over hundreds of years, ultimately the magnitude of carbon in each of those pixels changes so much that the linear relationship no longer applies to them. And it's for that reason that we really encourage the incorporation of these data into Earth system models. And those are the kind of models that take into account weather patterns and changes in plant growth and changes in precipitation and changes in all sorts of other processes, whether they're caused by humans or not. And when you incorporate all of the information from all of those processes, it's then that you're going to get a really good handle on what's happening to every single pixel on Earth.
Now, media reports say this added soil carbon could be equal to adding another United States in terms of emissions. I had a question about that. Does that mean 1 year of U.S. emissions could come from the soil by 2050, or that every year soils could release the same amount as the United States does now?
So I think the article that highlighted that was suggesting that it would be every year the soils will emit as much as the United States is doing now. I think it was calculated more roughly, though, based on we estimated that the carbon emissions from the soil are going to be approximately equivalent to 17% of current anthropogenic emissions, well, expected anthropogenic emissions over that time. So every year, humans will emit a certain amount, and then the soil will be responsible for an extra 17%. Whereas at the moment, the U.S. is also 17% of the total anthropogenic emissions. So it's really just sort of on that same order of magnitude. Every year, the soils will emit almost as much, well, about equivalent amounts of carbon that we expect to be emitted from the U.S.
It's like adding a new giant industrialized country just because of this new knowledge. Now, looking at the ramifications of that, the Paris Climate Agreement set what I think are very soft goals for countries to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Now we have this new scientific information. It seems to me, wouldn't the national goals have to either increase or be moved up in time in order to counterbalance the soil carbon loss your letter warns about?
Well, that may possibly be the case. I could only argue that the increasing emissions from the soil clarify, they really sort of drive home the necessity for us to at least be meeting the targets that we met in COP. And I completely agree. Now that we know the magnitude of these carbon losses from the soil, the more we learn about the carbon dynamics in the future, the more it suggests that we really need to cut down and, if possible, get lower than the sort of targets that they originally set at COP. But it's really that understanding of Earth system dynamics that allows us to set the right targets. And hopefully we can hit them in the future.
How serious do you think this news is, Thomas?
I think it's extremely serious, actually, because ultimately our current understanding of how the climate is changing is based on models, and several of these models didn't even really incorporate a thorough understanding of this feedback. In fact, they removed it from several of the models. So when this information is placed back into the models, it's certainly going to increase the rate at which we're expecting climate change to be. And so that just means that it's going to increase the rate at which all the catastrophic events associated with climate change are going to come into play. So it really stresses the urgency with which we need to start fighting against climate change.
And along those lines, your paper calls for a concerted international research effort to track the reaction of soils to warming. At the same time, as you know, President-elect Donald Trump's team announced a multi-billion dollar cut to climate research at NASA. You were in the Netherlands. Do you think that other countries can find enough political support to fund the soil carbon project without the United States?
Ultimately, I don't think that too many countries around the world are considering Mr. Trump's, at least his stance on climate change that he suggested during the election. I don't think they're taking that too seriously. Generally, politicians around the world are in agreement with almost all of the scientists that climate change is a serious and significant problem. So I think funding around the world for climate change research is certainly, well, hopefully going to remain high. And it's really for this reason that I actually think that Mr. Trump is in one of the strongest positions ever to be a president with the potential to have such a positive impact on the world. If he takes into account the overwhelming message from almost all of the scientists in the world, then certainly he can have one of the most positive impacts of any president in recent history, I think.
And what about the lack of data from the Southern Hemisphere? We have listeners there. Who can provide that information, and where are the priority countries for this research to get done?
Well, everywhere in the tropics, really. Ultimately, we need data from everywhere around the tropics to really see if they do fit our models. We predict that carbon losses from the tropics are not going to be inconsequential, really, because there's relatively small amount of carbon in the soil over there. Because, as I mentioned, the microbes are already warm, they're already respiring a lot, they're already decomposing all that plant material. But maybe there's going to be some sort of other changes that occur in the tropics that we didn't foresee. Maybe there's going to be increased uptake by the soils or something like that. So certainly we want to set up experiments over there. And I'm in the process of setting one up in Costa Rica. We also have people working in across Africa to try and set up these similar warming experiments. But ultimately, as you mentioned in your last comment, what we really need is sort of scientific funding on climate change to really be able to get a handle on the size of this effect and to really minimize that the size of that uncertainty so we can predict exactly what the climate's going to do in the future.
Well, your team's letter to the journal Nature generated some pretty good publicity. Have you received positive interest from other scientists or agencies or even governments?
The response has been amazing, absolutely. Governments in Europe as well as scientists all over the world have been absolutely very much in support of it. And I think it's hopefully going to spur on a lot of additional interest and funding in this really important research area.
Thomas Crowther, I know it's exciting to discover results in science, but this is really bad news heaped on already bad news. Does it bother you?
I have to admit, sometimes it does. I really, of course I want to understand the world, and if that understanding of the world can bring some sad news, then certainly it's not always enjoyable. And it seems very strange when you sort of celebrate a big discovery, but that discovery is about something so catastrophic for humanity. It's a really serious impact. But what I would stress is that I do certainly see the positive side of this. I think if we're going to fight against something as considerable as climate change, the first thing we need to do is understand how considerable it's going to be. And once we get a handle on future climate conditions, and once we understand what the climate's going to do, it's only then that we can really set meaningful targets to fight against it. So I like to believe that this is certainly contributing to our fight against climate change.
We've been talking about a worrying new addition to escalating greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The letter from 50 scientists just published in the journal Nature is titled Quantifying Global Soil Carbon Losses in Response to Warming. From the Netherlands Institute of Ecology, we've been speaking with the lead author, Dr. Thomas Crowther. Find links to Thomas and the science we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thomas, thank you so much for spending time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Been great to chat. Thanks very much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. If we knew how species changed in the past, maybe we could help our current living companions survive. Of course, we need to know how plants and animals react to a climate shift. That's part of what Jacqueline Gill does. At the University of Maine, Dr. Gill is a paleoecologist and a biogeographer. We'll find out what those terms mean and hopefully get a glimpse of how things go extinct, just in case we need to know ourselves. Officially, Jacqueline Gill is an assistant professor with the University of Maine School of Biology and Ecology and the Climate Change Institute. She's co-authored and been lead author of a series of papers that caught my eye. They're redefining how we think about conservation in a time of climate change. A few of those new tools and visions seem a bit scary to me. Jacqueline, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, it's not your ideas that worry me. It's what you and other scientists are discovering. Once we start to heat up the planet, the whole stage of living actor seems to become so fluid, so interlocked, so changeable. Talk to us about that.
So what I find really interesting about studying the past is that we have this series of natural experiments in climate change, in extinction, in introducing species to an area for the first time. And what we can learn from that range of natural experiments is that there are winners and there are losers under different conditions. And it's humans, our activities on the planet are also creating a series of winners and losers. And so we can look to the past for clues as to which species are going to be resilient to climate change, which species are going to do well in the sort of brave new world that is emerging because of our activities, and which species will be at risk. And one of the things I also work on is what are the consequences of losing species? There are sort of cascading effects of losing pieces to the puzzle. And I think that if we think about climate change and the unique challenges that it will pose to biodiversity, it's starting to be apparent that we really need to start to think outside the box a bit in terms of our conservation strategies. One of the really big take-home messages from, millions of years of climate change is that the idea of a community as a discrete unit of, you have a whole bunch of species living together. A community is very temporary, right? So we know that in response to climate change, even just since the end of the last ice age, species come together and they go apart in many cases because every species is reacting to climate change in its own unique way. And so there's been a big push in recent years to move away from thinking of species level conservation, because it's really difficult to save a million species with individual climate plans for each one. And so people are trying to come up with other ways of protecting as many species as possible. But we also know that thinking about a community as a static unit, right? If I go to, say, Acadia National Park, which is down the road from me, I can't necessarily expect all of those species to be there in 100 years, because every plant and animal is going to be trying to track its own habitat going into the next century. And so there's sort of a happy medium that we need to reach between trying to protect every individual species and its own unique needs, and also trying to hold on to this sort of static view of an ecosystem as a snapshot in time, because we know that ecosystems are dynamic, and sometimes that's part of how they can be resilient.
And it amazes me. I mean, you talk about a puzzle that you can remove just a small piece. As far as humans are concerned, it might be a bug or a bird, and suddenly a forest could die off. It's also interlocked.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I spend a lot of my time thinking about our largest animals, many of which we no longer have. We've lost most of the biggest animals on the planet just in the last 20,000 years or so, which is a really short period of time when it comes to, you know, ecosystems. I mean, it seems like a long time for us. Certainly, it's a long time for our governments and our institutions, or, you know, a 24-hour news cycle. But there's a lot of compelling evidence that the forests that we have today, for example, still notice the loss of woolly mammoths, you know, 12,000 years ago. And we think of a lot of keystone species today, like elephants or rhinoceroses, and they are the very last remnants that we have of these sort of ecosystem engineers that play a really important role in creating certain kinds of habitats that allow lots of other species to thrive. And so we can look to the conservation lessons that we've learned from observing what happens when you lose a woolly mammoth, and then take that to understanding what will happen if we lose elephants, or what would happen if we introduce bison into a new place, for example. It kind of goes both ways. It's maybe a controversial idea, but I think that there's a lot of evidence that not all species have the same impacts in their ecosystem. And so thinking about, you know, focusing our limited conservation dollars and attention on those species that might have the biggest impacts if we were to lose them could be one way of doing some sort of environmental triage.
Well, we'll get more into the idea of environmental triage. That's one of the scary ideas to me. But before we dig into the science that you do, an article in Rolling Stone magazine has you saying that paleoecology reveals, quote, really compelling evidence that there can be events of abrupt climate change that can happen well within human lifespans. We're talking less than a decade, end quote. Jacqueline, can you describe what kind of change, maybe with an example?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the poster child example, where we really started to realize that abrupt climate change could happen very quickly and on very relevant timescales, was looking at how the Earth system came out of the last ice age. It wasn't just necessarily like turning up the thermostat on the Earth. Moving from one regime, which would be sort of a full ice age condition, into our current warm period, the interglacial that we live in now, as we kind of come from one phase to another phase, there's often a lot of upheaval that's associated with those kinds of transitions. And so I like to think of it as, if you walk into a dark room, it's not like flipping the light switch and suddenly everything is bright, with the analogy being that you're going from sort of an ice house earth to a greenhouse earth. The analogy is more like walking into a room and then flipping the switch on and off, sort of flickering back and forth. And that flickering may be a kind of an early warning signal that that a big transition is coming in the climate system. And there's some evidence that we might be seeing fingerprints like that on the climate system today. But if we look back to that last period of real global warming that the planet experienced, which was at the end of the last ice age, there were several of these abrupt events that happened. First, there was an abrupt warm event known as the Bolling Alarod that happened about 14,500 years ago. And so there was a several degrees Celsius warming that happened quite quickly. And then just 1,000 years later, there was an abrupt cold event where it was a very quick return to ice age conditions. Glaciers started advancing again, tundra reappeared in many places, and that would have happened, you know, again within maybe a decade or less. And then the end of that event, about 1,000 years later, was also very abrupt. So within less than a century, several degrees Celsius warming, which is what we're looking at in the next century today. And so these kinds of very quick events were very shocking to scientists a few decades ago when we first discovered just how quickly the climate system could shift like that. Because the Earth's climate system is very complex, there are often lags in the system, especially because the oceans play such an important role, and the oceans tend to be very slow climate-wise. Because of the physics of water and how it works, it takes a lot of energy and a long time to sort of heat up or cool down, which is, as a side note, one of the reasons why if we were to shut down all greenhouse gas emissions now, we'd still be committed to a certain amount of warming just because the oceans still have to catch up. But even though we have these sort of slow processes in the climate system, there are things that can happen very abruptly, and that tends to involve the atmosphere and the way energy moves through the atmosphere, particularly with things like the jet stream. So one kind of small example that many of us would have been familiar with a couple winters ago was the polar vortex, right? This idea that you can have a stuck weather pattern with a lot of cold air kind of coming out of the Arctic and kind of creating an extreme event. And those kinds of events might be more common in the near future because of things like reducing the sea ice extent in the Arctic, right? So as we sort of move into a new regime in the climate system where we have less sea ice, we might start to see some of these kind of extreme events happening more. And so there's sort of short-term responses in the climate system as well as these sort of longer-term responses in the climate system. But those extreme events are often associated with changes in the atmosphere, which can happen very, very quickly. You know, we've all experienced those sudden events just even in terms of how we experience weather. Well, the same kinds of processes can play out as sort of longer-term trends in the climate.
Well, Jacqueline Gill, what is the BEAST Lab, and what does that acronym stand for?
Oh, good question. So we call our lab the BEAST Lab, where BEAST stands for Biodiversity and Environmental Change Across Space and Time. And so the space and time really reflects the fact that I am a paleoecologist, so we do a lot of research on changes through time, because I think time is a really important perspective if you want to understand environmental problems. And we also do a lot of research kind of zoomed out across space as well. And so if any of your listeners are Doctor Who fans, you know, a big contender was to be the TARDIS lab or the timey-wimey lab. But just this idea that we kind of are really taking a four-dimensional approach to environmental problems, because there's a lot that you can learn by taking change across space into account, so sort of a geographic perspective, as well as thinking about change through time. So we like a lot of kind of big picture thinking in this lab.
Well, I also ran into your blog called The Contemplative Mammoth, and you mentioned mammoths. I paid a visit. I was totally shocked to find that mammoths still lived when modern humans were farming. Is that possible?
Yeah, so this is really interesting, actually. And I like to call this idea of mammoth time, that for a lot of people, you know, you might have gotten one of those little plastic tubes of toys, you know, when you were a kid that had dinosaurs, and there may have been like some saber tooths and woolly mammoths thrown in together. You know, never mind that T-Rex and a mammoth were separated by 60 million years, 65 million years of time. But people just sort of think like it's a prehistoric creature, it's a fossil, you know, it's not relevant to my day-to-day life. And what's interesting is if you realize just how recently mammoths were around, you I think might come to appreciate the role that they would have in our ecosystems a little bit better. And you know, most of the mammoths and other Ice Age animals were wiped out across the globe by, you know, 10 to 12,000 years ago. But there were a couple of populations of mammoths that held out until just a couple thousand years ago in some of the Arctic islands off of Siberia and Alaska. So Wrangel Island and St. Paul Island had these populations of woolly mammoths that persisted much, much longer. And in fact, would have been around during the time of the pyramids, during times when we had things like agriculture, writing, you know, number systems, even the wheel had been discovered at that point. And so I talked in my blog about how it would have been completely possible to have had a chariot drawn by a dwarf woolly mammoth if you had been able to put the two together at the right place, right? They were around at the same time, but they were just separated by a lot of geography. But if you think about that, you know, suddenly woolly mammoth time is much closer to our human civilization than people might normally think. And that, I think, allows you to start thinking about, okay, well, what are the impacts of the extinction of these Ice Age creatures? You know, what can we learn by studying the past? And how will that help us protect everything from elephants to Osage orange trees?
Okay, so what is a biogeographer?
A biogeographer is someone who studies basically where things live and why they don't live where they don't. And so really thinking about the distribution of where species are found and how that relates to climate, especially. But so thinking about the patterns of biodiversity on the Earth, like one classic problem in biogeography, for example, is why we tend to have more species closer to the equator than we have fewer as we go to the poles. And there are lots of kind of ecological puzzles like that. If you start to map out the distribution of life on Earth, you start to find some really interesting patterns that can really help you understand not only just individual species and their own unique needs, but also just how life works in general, and just having a really good grounding in, you know, the sort of mechanic of our ecosystems is, I think, crucial to being able to protect them.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
By the way, you are listening to Jacqueline Gill from the University of Maine. We are talking about the changing mosaic of living things and extinction in times of rapid warming. I'm your host, Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. I'd like to get to what I see as kind of a founding paper. It was published in Conservation Biology in April 2015. The title is The Theory Behind and the Challenges of Conserving Nature's Stage in a Time of Rapid Change. The lead author is Joshua J. Lawler, with yourself as one of the co-authors. Jacqueline, what is that paper about? Why is it important?
That's a great question. So I talked earlier in the show about how we might need to start thinking outside the box in terms of conservation strategies. And there's a lot of interest in figuring out what the scale of conservation is. What's the grain size, so to speak? Are we going to try to keep focusing on individual species when those species themselves are moving around? Are we going to try to focus on conserving an entire ecosystem when we know that the components of that ecosystem are going to wink in and out as species track their individual climate needs and other environmental needs? And so what that does is it presents a really interesting challenge. And to really explain that challenge, I want to talk a little bit about the Endangered Species Act, which it turns out is not very robust when it comes to climate change. It's been the way here in the United States that we have been able to protect species that are at risk. And those individual species have to be listed under the Endangered Species Act, and they have to have detailed recovery plans that are very specific to the biology of each of those organisms. And so what the Endangered Species Act does is it protects the place where the animal is found now. So let's say that there was, I don't know, a piping plover that I was really interested in protecting, or a species of bat, we'll say. And the place where that bird or bat is living now is protected under federal mandate, right? Well, what happens if the climate warms and that bird moves a couple hundred kilometers north to breed on a beach that's not protected? And there's not necessarily a quick response in terms of getting that new area protected for that bird. And meanwhile, the place that the bird has left is no longer going to be protected, which could have impacts to all kinds of other animals that may not necessarily have made it onto that Endangered Species Act yet. And so, you know, even just in terms of trying to protect the species that we have today under existing legislation, these regulations like the Endangered Species Act were not really designed for species that would be moving around because of climate change. And so this has gotten a lot of people thinking, like, well, what are the alternatives? If we don't focus on individual species, what should we be focusing on in terms of our conservation strategies? And there's this really interesting pattern, to go back to biogeography for a minute, which is that places that have a lot of geological diversity, so places with a lot of different rock types, a lot of landform types, different kinds of habitats that are, you know, very static, like cliffs, lots of geologic features, mountains, lots of interesting topography, those places tend to also have a lot of species. And that's an interesting pattern that people have started to identify. And so there's something inherent to having a lot of geodiversity that also tends to promote a lot of biodiversity. And there are a couple ideas about why that might be. There may be something just unique to having lots of habitat allows you to protect a lot of species. Maybe having lots of geological diversity means that you don't have a lot of human development, right? You know, there's a reason a lot of our national parks in the States tend to be in places that aren't really great for agriculture, for example, right? Places like Yosemite are very gorgeous, but for practical purposes, you know, weren't necessarily the first place people wanted to put farms in cities. It was just one reason that they ended up being protected kind of in an unintentional way. So the idea in terms of what's known as conserving nature stage is the idea is if you think about the environment as the stage and species are the actors, instead of trying to protect or conserve the actors themselves, you just protect the stage. And the actors may come and go, and we might have to let go of some of our fixation on individual actors, but just be happy with the fact that we have a lot of biodiversity per se. And this is a pretty controversial idea, right? Because it might mean having to give up certain species that we care about and then trying to get people to care about something kind of abstract, which is just this idea of biodiversity. Having more species is good. We don't have to care necessarily about who those species are. But most people, you know, get into conservation because there are species or habitats that they really care about, right? I mean, people who are birders or, you know, other folks, botanists, people who are foragers, they get into conservation because they care about a particular environment or they care about a particular species. And so it's a really hard sell for a lot of people to get them to kind of give up on the idea of, you know, that piping plover or that bat that they really care about and just take consolation that over the long haul of climate change, and we're talking centuries to thousands of years or more, if we can protect these geodiverse regions, we will have more biodiversity protected. So it's like taking an umbrella approach that's based on the physical geography of a place rather than, you know, necessarily biodiversity hotspots per se.
I do find that a little unsettling because we've realized that we're entering perhaps the next sixth great mass extinction event. And you've talked about triage. And for listeners who aren't sure, triage in medical terms is when, for example, a hospital gets far too many people coming in with serious wounds or illnesses and they have to decide who gets treated first and perhaps who lives and who dies. Is that where we are now with other living things on this planet?
Oh, it's so hard to say. I mean, the reality is that we have very limited conservation dollars, and certainly in this country, the resources for science have been declining, even as the demand for those resources has increased. And I worry that, you know, if we don't start to prioritize, we will be bad at protecting the species that are most important, whether those are the ones that we care about or they provide some kind of important function on the landscape that we want to preserve or they're important for, you know, human health and livelihoods. And so I worry that we're approaching a tipping point in terms of our ability to keep a hold of the number of species that need to be protected, especially when you think about the fact that a lot of the Earth's biodiversity is concentrated in places that are the poorest. They have the fewest resources in terms of protecting species. So if we're having a hard time, you know, here in the United States, managing the conservation of species with our existing infrastructure and regulations and NGOs and lots of, you know, local interest groups, you know, imagine being in a place where most of the biodiversity is. And a lot of those places are actively being deforested and converted into croplands or rangelands. And those countries don't necessarily, in the developing world, have the same kind of infrastructure to protect species. I mean, I hate to use the term triage because it means, you know, letting go of making conscious decisions about which species to let go. And by let go, I mean watch them go into extinction. And extinction, in theory, is forever, although as people are talking more about de-extinction and resurrecting species, maybe that's not necessarily true anymore, but I prefer to think about it in terms of prioritizing. So one of the reasons that I think looking at the paleo record is so valuable is that it allows me to focus my energies on protecting the species or the ecosystem processes that are going to be the most important. And so if there are some species that are really resilient to global change, we need to know who those are, right? So that we can divert attention away from them and onto the species that are the most vulnerable. And so rather than thinking about it in terms of triage, maybe a better way, at least for now, would be to think about it in terms of sort of a process of focusing our energy, not because everything else will go extinct, but to focus on the things that are most at risk, at least now. Because I think there are lots of stories of resilience. We often get caught up on the stories about risk, about species that are going extinct, but you know, there are species that have made it through quite a lot of environmental changes. And so understanding which species those are or what it is about them or their communities that makes them more resilient is, I think, really important. In my work, I talk a lot about the extinction of Ice Age animals, things like mammoths and giant ground sloths and, you know, beaver the size of black bears. And we've lost those species forever, or at least until George Church's lab at Harvard brings the woolly mammoth back. But at the same time, if you look outside your window right now, every plant and animal that you see is an Ice Age survivor. And there's a tremendous amount of resilience that we don't pay nearly enough attention to, which isn't to say that we should just say, well, everything's going to be fine, but it allows us to focus that sort of limited energy and those limited resources on the most vulnerable species.
We've been told that if the temperature goes up 3 degrees C or more, the first to go would be the large mammals. And doesn't that describe humans as well?
Yeah, so humans are really interesting because we have a whole lot of behavioral adaptations that have made us incredibly resilient. We can modify our environment. We can utilize a really diverse array of, you know, foodstuffs, and those kinds of traits have made us super successful as a species. On the other hand, at a certain level, there are hard and fast limits in physiology that proteins denature at a certain temperature, right? You can only withstand temperatures that are so hot before, you know, you just can't anymore. And so big animals definitely can be at risk during warmer periods. But one benefit that big animals tend to have is that they can move around relative to smaller animals. They can kind of get to the places that they need to get to. That's harder if the place you need to get to is paved over or there's no corridor to get there, which is why, you know, protecting large swaths of land is really important if we want to protect our biggest animals. So that's definitely a concern. But there are still also some behavioral adaptations to kind of persisting in place, whether that's changing the time of day that you're active or, you know, using water more or mud or other kinds of physical activities to kind of modify your immediate microclimate. And a lot of animals have figured out strategies like that, but they're really only good in the short term. We have to make sure that we have places for these big animals to go, because we know from, you know, research that's been done in my lab and by other folks that these really large animals tend to have really disproportionate impact on their environments, and that when we lose them, we might actually be making their habitats less resilient to climate change. There's some really cool work that's been done in Greenland looking at grasslands that have had herbivores kept out and then have allowed herbivores in. And what they found is that over, I think it was like a 15-year or period of warming, and this was some work by Eric Post, where they had a grazing exclosure and they kept animals out from this grassland. And the grassland that warmed up with animals was much more resilient than the grassland that warmed up but where the animals were kept out. So it was kind of a convoluted way of saying big animals may actually help buffer the impact of climate change on plants. And some of the work that I've done in my lab on Ice Age herbivores and their extinction also supports this idea that large herbivores are somehow buffering the impacts of climate change on vegetation. And that, you know, again, shows that there are certain animals that maybe we should be focusing our efforts and attention on. Which is funny, too, because, you know, so many people have been saying, oh, it's always the charismatic megafauna. We need to stop worrying about, you know, these. We pay all our attention on these really big, attractive animals. And then meanwhile, the little, you know, slugs and fungi and other things that are important don't get any attention. But it may turn out that the charismatic megafauna have such a big impact on their environments that they deserve some attention, at least.
Well, we're starting to wrap up, but researching your work, I kept finding the phrase no analog future. What does that mean, and why is it so disturbing to natural scientists?
Oh, it's a good question. So when we look at the past, we have identified periods following the end of the last ice age where the climates and also the ecological communities, the forest types, have no modern analog. So they're really novel in terms of anything we see on the landscape today. And we know that when climates are novel, so novel combinations of temperature and precipitation that we just don't find on the landscape anywhere on the planet now, when the climates were novel in the past, the ecosystems responded in unpredictable ways, right? Sort of going into a no man's land or an uncharted territory, I guess, like here be dragons, right? And we know that those kinds of climate changes are happening now. Novel climates are emerging, you know, now and in the next century. in many cases because we're making warm places warmer than we have anywhere on the planet. We're changing combinations of temperature and precipitation. So the tropics, for example, may be especially at risk of these emerging new climates, and we may be losing other combinations of climate. And that's going to matter to species who need those combinations of climates, right? If you can only live within a certain range of temperature or precipitation conditions. But the other thing I think that is the important take home is that where we don't have an analog, it becomes really difficult to make a prediction. So protecting species in this sort of no man's land of knowledge becomes incredibly challenging for especially people really on the front lines, the people who are managing reserves, or if you have a particular, you know, conservation easement or something that you need to take care of.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. We have been talking with Dr. Jacqueline Gill. She's a kind of time hunter, although that's officially called a paleoecologist and a biogeographer. Jacqueline is an assistant professor at the University of Maine School of Biology, Ecology, and the Climate Change Institute. She's active in the research community and publishes scientific papers, which I think are on the leading edge. I'll put links to those and to Jacqueline's Woolly Mammoth blog in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Jacqueline, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Oh, heavenly grid, help us spare up thy standard, our chevron flashing bright across the gulf of compromise, standing humble on the rich field of mobile American thinking. Here in this shell, we call life.
It sounds like our best scientists will need outlets like Radio EcoShock even more than ever. According to an article at Politico.com published December 9th, quote, Donald Trump's transition team wants the Energy Department to provide the names of any employees who have worked on President Barack Obama's climate initiatives, a request that has current and former staffers fearing an oncoming witch hunt. End quote. That's on top of the Trump team's threats to cut $2 billion in climate research at NASA. Welcome to the new dark age, where the religion of money trumps reality. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, where I'll continue to pump out climate science direct from the source as long as my brain and breath continue. I'm Alex Smith. Please tell your friends and anyone who will listen about this program. And please join us again next week for more. You've heard bits from my new Radio EcoShock song. It's called Future EcoShock. Find the whole thing to listen, download, or share at soundcloud.com. or at my own website, ecoshock.org. Here it is, Future EcoShock.
Once you know the future, look out for it. We all have it. We all have. Know the future. We all have it.
kind of radical pro-Israeli partisans have, in essence, conceded defeat. And what they're now trying to do, instead of fight this discourse on the facts, is simply literally to rewrite it, to frame a new narrative for a new generation of young people.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Human rights activists in Virginia are fighting to protect the quality and accuracy in history and social studies textbooks in elementary and high schools in the state, as Israel advocacy organizations are proposing substantial changes to the texts. Proposed edits by Israel lobby groups would change the way Israeli history is depicted in textbooks, deliberately whitewashing its military occupation and ongoing policies of land theft, apartheid, and expulsion of Palestinians. The Virginia Coalition for Human Rights, along with professors and educators around the state, are urging textbook publishers Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, McGraw-Hill, Prentice Hall, and National Geographic not to adopt what they say are factually challenged, biased, and exclusionary recommendations, and have appealed to the state's leadership as well. Joining us to talk about this are three guests: Paul Norsey, co-chair of the Virginia Coalition of Human Rights; Dr. Michael Fischbach, professor of history at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia; and Jean Trabulsi, an educator in Northern Virginia.
As a university professor, I am perpetually astounded by the lack of knowledge that students come with. I think many people who probably listen to your show, who go, you know, onto Electronic Intifada on the internet, are very familiar with the Middle East and may not sometimes stop to think how different they are from so many people. I mean, I deal with college students. Okay, we're not even talking about just regular people. These are college students who will say to me, in all seriousness, by the end of the course, you know, I just thought Israel was a country. It had been around for a long time, forever, and Palestine and the Palestinians were this other country, and they were trying to take over the Israelis. I mean, any concept of the Zionist project of settler colonialism turning an Arab part of the Middle East into a Jewish state, completely outside their conception, let alone wider issues about Islam, Muslims, Arabs. Arabs are not Turks. Turks are not Persians. Persians are not Arabs. I mean, sometimes things that people listening to this podcast would take for granted is so sorely lacking. And that's why this kind of situation is so dangerous, is that it takes an already relatively uninformed group of people, young people, they are learning after all, and twisting them into a whole different direction, which can only compound it. And like I said, those of us who teach at the university level already see this kind of profound misunderstanding of the entire Middle East, not to mention the Arab-Israeli conflict. We already see that as a problem, and this would only make it worse.
Thanks. Jean, let's talk about the campaign. How many professors and educators have signed on to support the fight against these proposed interferences by Israel lobby groups into the state textbooks? And why do you think it's important that educators join the campaign?
Yes, I have to refer to Paul here. Paul, was it 16?
Yeah.
A signatory?
There are 14 current signatories that are professors that specialize in Middle East or history in Virginia. We cut it off when we contacted people. As you know, we learned about this issue in April. We had to act quickly. We got our letter out at the end of May. We had to, when we sent the letter out in draft, we asked people to let us know. I think initially we asked for within a week. We had trouble getting responses. We sent it another week, but we had to cut it off because we had to publish the letter because time, you know, the clock was ticking, and we were afraid the publishers were going to go ahead and start making some of these edits. But we did, even after we published this, we were told some of the professors told us that they knew other professors that would want to sign on. So I don't think the 14, I think the 14 that have signed on are a microcosm of the academic community that would come forth and support this. I think just like Dr. Fishbach was saying, you know, they're on the front lines. They see the results of, inadequate education, I guess, in this regard, firsthand, but we really all do. And, so we have 14 so far. We think there are more that are willing, and we may publish more if we need to. We may continue this campaign. We're hoping with that this is probably enough to a critical mass that we can now engage the decision makers, the publishers, and the Secretary of or the Department of Education. The key was to make them aware that this is a really serious issue, and that you know, it's not just one or two people that are bringing this up. This is a serious academic issue, and there are many academics that will vouch for that. And so I think we've achieved that purpose. We also, all the member groups of the Virginia Coalition for Human Rights, which are 16 member groups, have all signed on to this as well, and particularly signed on to this letter, not just as, you know, not just because they're members of the coalition, but for this particular issue. And also we are aware of many other groups that are supportive of this. We just didn't have time to reach out to all of them and list them all. You know, I think this is a fairly straightforward issue where, you know, let's call things what they are. Settlements are illegal settlements are illegal settlements. They should be called out as such. Military occupation is a military occupation. It needs to be called out as such. It needs to be taught as such in the textbooks. This is very basic, and I'm optimistic that a lot of people will agree to that and act on it, and maybe we can have some positive impact.
Well, if people do want to learn more about the campaign, get involved, and perhaps start investigating in their own states, if they're not in Virginia, to see how and if these kinds of edits have been made to their communities' textbooks, where can they go?
That would be www.vchr.org. We would also ask people to contact Governor Northam, if you're a Virginian, state legislators in Richmond, officials at the Virginia Department of Education, and spread the word about the issue on social media and to friends in other states, especially our friends in Oklahoma and Kentucky, where the textbook review cycles are going on right now, and ICS is proposing edits for the textbooks in those two states.
Again, that website for the Virginia Coalition for Human Rights is vchr.org. Paul, did you want to add something?
Yeah. Additionally, I'd urge people to not just wait for something like this to happen, but to proactively work with their educational institutions, all the way from their local schools, all the way to the state departments of education, in terms of what is being taught, whether it's textbook or other things. With the textbooks, as we've mentioned, not only are there these very erroneous edits being proposed, but already the existing textbooks need improvement. So, ideally we could be proactively advocating for improvements to these textbooks, not just trying to defend against edits that would degrade the quality of the textbooks. So that's one thing. And like Gene said, we do need help. If people can call their state representatives at the state level, because this is a state issue, and it, you know, the education, Secretary of Education of the state, and the House of Delegates and the state Senate in Richmond and Virginia. And they can do the same things in other states.
Great. Well, we're going to leave it right there. We're of course, going to keep watching this story. And so I hope that you all keep us updated on the campaign as it moves along. That has been the voice of Paul Norsey. He's the co-chair of the Virginia Coalition of Human Rights. Also with us was Dr. Michael Fishbach, professor of history at Randolph-Macon College, and Jean Trebulsi, an educator in Northern Virginia. Paul, Michael, and Jean, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakut, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Elliot Mintzberg of the group People for the American Way, who discusses the coming high-stakes Senate debate and vote on confirming a successor for retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. Bill Fletcher Jr., a lifelong labor activist and author, who assesses the damage suffered by the U.S. labor movement resulting from last week's Supreme Court ruling in the Janus versus AFSCME case. And Jim Torn, founder of the group Footprints for Peace, who talks about a 1,400-mile bike ride he organized to bring attention to the case of indigenous political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who's been incarcerated for 43 years. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Amid the Trump regime's brutal crackdown on migrants from Central America, detainees have been subjected to forced labor, a pernicious form of human trafficking. According to In These Times magazine, private prison corporations, who operate most of the nation's immigrant detention centers, are illegally forcing migrants to work for sub-minimum wages. Over the last year, lawsuits have been filed against CoreCivic, formerly the Correction Corporation of America, and Geo Group. The lawsuits claim prison company staff have threatened detainees with solitary confinement or the withholding of basic goods like food or toilet paper if they refuse to work 7 days a week. The lawsuits are all related to the voluntary work program run by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, that offers work to detainees for $1 a day. A 2014 New York Times investigation identified 55 immigration detention centers running the volunteer work program, 34 of which were run by private corporations. There's reason to believe thousands of the roughly 35,000 people in immigrant detention are currently being coerced into labor. In some detention facilities, the labor program has provoked hunger strikes and protests. However, in previous lawsuits, U.S. courts have ruled detained immigrants are not employees and therefore are not protected by U.S. labor law. Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram, now an affiliate of the Islamic State, emerged as a murderous threat over the last decade in the Lake Chad Basin. Its name literally means Western education is forbidden. According to the United Nations Children's Fund, the Islamic movement has kidnapped over 1,000 children and killed over 2,300 teachers. The group gained international attention when it kidnapped 276 schoolgirls in Chibok in 2014. Despite a 3-year offensive to wipe out Boko Haram, the insurgency still carries out regular attacks against schools and villages. In mid-June, a pair of suicide bombers killed 31 people in the city of Damboa during the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, demonstrating that the terrorist group still has the capacity to inflict mass casualties. It's estimated that 57% of schools in Borno State, in the heart of the insurgency, are closed, and over half of the state's schools have been destroyed. But in a sign of resilience, UNICEF and humanitarian agencies are offering free open-air classes for primary school students. In Maiduguri, a bustling city of 1 million, secondary schools have reopened, and many are now absorbing thousands of students and teachers from other parts of the state. Minutes after the tragic crash of a Cuban airliner as it took off from Havana's Jose Marti International Airport, state-run media was filled with breaking news updates and cell phone videos reporting on the crash that killed 112 people, the worst airline crash in Cuba in decades. This openness in the Cuban state media is a new development under newly named President Miguel Díaz-Canel, even as independent print and broadcast media remains banned. According to the Associated Press, the Political Bureau of the Cuban Communist Party has approved a new communications policy to give state media more flexibility in reporting breaking news. Media outlets are also now allowed to sell advertising to Cuba's small but emerging private sector. Cuba still has one of the lowest internet use rates in the world, but access is now expanding rapidly. Cubans with online access can find a nearly unlimited range of media outlets, from independent Cuban online magazines to anti-Castro outlets funded by the U.S. government. Many of those sites are blocked, but their content can be accessed through Facebook and other social media. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Trump welcomed the news that Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy would be retiring before the critical midterm election this November. Trump is now moving quickly to nominate a successor to replace Kennedy, which creates an opportunity to cement in place a conservative majority on the high court for a generation to come. Nominees he'll be considering come from a list compiled by the right-wing Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation. Although he was appointed by a Republican president, Kennedy had a reputation of being a moderate voice on the court due to his alliance with liberal justices on key cases involving gay rights, abortion, and affirmative action. However, Kennedy, more often than not, sided with conservatives, most notably writing the controversial 2010 Citizens United ruling that struck down limits on corporations' campaign spending, and in the 2013 Shelby County v. Holder case that gutted the Voting Rights Act. With Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell pledging to vote on a Trump nominee this fall, Democrats are crying foul, pointing out that after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, McConnell took the unprecedented step of blocking a vote on President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland until after the 2016 election, when Trump's nominee Neil Gorsuch was confirmed. Your reporter spoke with Elliot Mintzberg, senior fellow with the group People for the American Way, who discusses what's at stake in the coming Senate debate and vote on confirming a successor for Justice Kennedy.
There's no question that the addition not only of Alito, but most recently of Gorsuch to the court, has given new energy to those on the far right, and they were able to succeed in getting Justice Kennedy, who is himself pretty conservative, to go along with them in all of those very troubling cases. No question that we need to win more presidential elections and get people appointed to the Supreme Court a lot more like Sotomayor and Kagan and Ginsburg, who've done an heroic job in dissenting from those decisions. But as bad as those decisions are, it could be even worse if Trump can put another Gorsuch or somebody else from his list on the Supreme Court to replace Kennedy.
What's at stake, in your view, in terms of Supreme Court rulings in the future that could affect generations to come? What are some of the high-stakes issues that the justices will likely be deciding in the years ahead?
Well, we're really talking all the marbles. I mean, there are cases already on the court's docket that relate to abortion, to lots of other issues. But Kennedy has been the thin dividing line that's made the difference between, for example, overturning Roe versus Wade, which the right really wants to do, and preserving some reproductive rights for women. That one is high on the chopping block if they're able to get someone like a Gorsuch in to replace Kennedy. Challenges to the Affordable Care Act. Mr. Trump has a lawsuit going now with Mr. Sessions that tries to argue that it's unconstitutional for Congress to require insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions. Add a justice like Gorsuch to the court, and there's serious concern about what happens in a case like that. LGBTQ rights, equal marriage rights, others. Kennedy was the author of many of those crucial decisions, and there have been clear indications from the conservatives on the court that they'd like to get rid of that awful decision, according to them. Stopping executive abuse. He was the deciding vote in the author of the opinion that said that President Bush couldn't lock people up at Guantanamo without at least a writ of habeas corpus. That one could be gone, too. All these and more are seriously threatened if you have another Gorsuch or someone potentially even worse replacing Kennedy on the Supreme Court.
Certainly one of the options that Democrats have is to convince one of a handful of Republicans who are on the record opposed to the overturning of Roe versus Wade to oppose a nominee that would likely do that. And that includes Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. But then there's the problem of red state Democrats who are in tough election years. Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, Claire McCaskill in Missouri are four that I've heard may be convinced to support a Trump nominee. Can you tell us a little bit about what's in play here and what you're leaning towards as a wise and effective option?
Well, you are absolutely right. There is a narrow path to victory here for progressives, and the path goes through those six states. Right now, the Senate is only 50-49 because Senator McCain is unlikely to return from Arizona. So that means we need to hold the Democrats, or almost all of them, and get a net of one Republican vote. And that's not easy, but it's definitely doable. We have already begun efforts to reach out to people in those states and try to get them to contact their senators. We're looking very carefully at all the statements they've made. Senator Collins, for example, has talked about she doesn't want to see a judicial activist. The primary contenders for the Supreme Court seat are exactly that, and that needs to be explained very carefully. But whether the method used is to actually vote a nominee down or potentially to vote in the Senate to delay considering a nominee, which a majority of the Senate will do, we need that. We need a majority of the Senate. And we've already begun efforts, and it's critical to have people like your listeners involved with that to convince those six senators and others, although most other Democratic senators, I think, are pretty clearly on the right path already from the statements they've made. But to convince, I would say, five out of six of those senators to do the right thing, whether it's on a procedural vote or on a vote on the merits on the nominee.
That was Elliot Mintzberg, senior fellow with the group People for the American Way. Find more commentary on the political fight over filling Justice Kennedy's Supreme Court seat by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Following a pattern of decisions hostile to the U.S. labor movement, the Supreme Court ruled on June 27th that public sector unions could no longer charge agency or fair share fees to employees who declined to join the union, but who continue to benefit from the contracts unions must negotiate with management on their behalf. The case Janus v. Ask Me, decided by a 5-4 vote, overturned a 40-year-old precedent set by the High Court in the 1977 Abood v. Detroit Board of Education case. The conservative court majority justified their ruling, which dramatically undermines unions representing police, firefighters, teachers, and other government workers across the U.S., by claiming that requiring public employees to pay agency fees is a violation of their First Amendment right to free speech, even though agency fees cannot be used to pay for union lobbying or political activity. As a result of this ruling, it's predicted that hundreds of thousands of workers will likely opt out of paying agency fees, thereby reducing public sector union revenue and their political influence. This is exactly the goal long sought by the conservative anti-union groups who bankrolled the Janus case. Your reporter spoke with Bill Fletcher, Jr., a former senior staff person with the AFL-CIO, past president of Trans-Africa Forum, and a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies. Here, Fletcher assesses the damage the ruling in the Janus case may cause the U.S. labor movement and how unions could respond.
In a Supreme Court decision called Steel versus Louisville Railroad, 1944, set the precedent for all future duty of fair representation cases. The court was very clear that a union, because it has exclusive representation rights, was obligated to represent fairly and equitably all workers in a bargaining unit, irrespective of union membership, meaning that the union had to represent people who were non-union. In the public sector, what happened over the years was that workers, when employed, would not have to join the union. However, they would pay a fee, which is the agency fee or fair share fee, that would cover the cost of representation. Whether the worker is in the union or not, the union has to represent them on any credible grievance. That means that they have to take it to arbitration if necessary, which can be very expensive. The union might have to litigate a matter in court. It may be something that has to be taken before a state legislature or a city council. All of this costs money. What the Supreme Court was saying was that, yes, we hear that, but it's going to be up to the union. The union will have to use its own resources to pay for this, because to ask a worker to pay their fair share is somehow an infringement on their freedom of speech. Now, the other part of this that is critical to emphasize is that being in a union does not in any way stop your freedom of speech. You can be a union member and not agree with unions. You can be a union member and oppose the leadership of the union. You can be in a union and oppose the stand, the political stand that the union takes. None of that is prohibited by being a union member. So the whole notion that this was about free speech is nothing more than sophistry. It really was about crushing the power of organized workers. That's what the decision was about.
What's the likely fallout from this Supreme Court decision? We've heard predictions of the loss of hundreds of thousands of dues-paying workers, non-union members who could decide to opt out of paying their fair share fees. How much could this weaken the labor movement in the United States?
Well, there's no question but that it could possibly weaken the unions, because what you have to understand is open shop is what it's called when workers don't have to join the union or pay a fee, called right to work in some states. What open shop does is that it appeals to greed. And it's really interesting because there's no other institution in the United States that is obligated by law and with no governmental subsidy is obligated to represent people who are not making a contribution. It would be as if the people of a city or town were given the option of paying taxes, but they would be guaranteed fire, police, sewer, water, and education. That's the equivalent. So that's why it's so completely ridiculous. So this will drain resources of unions. No question about it.
With record inequality that we see in the United States, some of the worst rates of inequality anywhere in the world in the industrialized nations, and now with a burgeoning militant teachers union movement in a lot of unexpected places, including Oklahoma, we have maybe an opportunity now during this Trump administration where they've gone full tilt in favor of corporations and against workers and in decisions they make day after day. Is there a potential here in the wake of this Supreme Court ruling that you'll see a lot of new energy and militancy among the labor movement?
There's tremendous potential, but there's been potential for a while. And so, for example, you think about in 2011 with the Occupy movement, you think about the Madison uprising in Wisconsin. Workers have demonstrated time and again a willingness to resist. Challenge, however, is that if you don't have good organization and good leadership, what this becomes is a phenomena of periodic eruptions, but not a major insurrection. One of the things that I've been feeling for a while is that we need to challenge the corporate right exactly where they least expect us to, which is insisting upon rights at work, not right to work, but rights at work. So one thing that I have been advocating for a while is the necessity for unions and other economic justice organizations to be pushing around the country fights to bring about a democratization of the workplace, rights at work, beginning with basic protection against unfair terminations. So there's ways of turning this around, but we need the union movement to step up to the plate and act as a real fighting organization or set of organizations that's not just looking out after its own members.
That was Bill Fletcher Jr., a lifelong labor and racial justice activist and author of several books, including They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Find more analysis and commentary on the Janus ruling by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Leonard Peltier is probably the best-known indigenous person held behind bars in the U.S. In 1977, he was convicted of killing two FBI agents during a period of extreme violence on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota and sentenced to two consecutive life sentences. His trial was rife with improprieties, including perjury by key witnesses for the prosecution, the withholding of evidence in his favor, and more. He has consistently been turned down for parole, and President Barack Obama declined to grant Peltier clemency before leaving office. An international campaign to free Peltier has been ongoing for 40 years. As part of that campaign, a Cincinnati-based group called Footprints for Peace just completed a 1,400-mile bike ride from Cincinnati, Ohio, to the Pine Ridge Reservation. Since 2005, the group has sponsored long-distance runs, walks, and bike rides to promote causes such as nuclear nonproliferation and indigenous rights, and has specifically organized three bike rides on behalf of Leonard Peltier. Footprints for Peace founder Jim Torin, along with three others, rode together to the Pine Ridge Reservation, where the Peltier case began on June 26, 1975. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Torin, who talks about the bike ride and its goals.
This year, it just seemed right for us to ride to where it all started, which was the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. We started in Cincinnati on May 27th, and we rode approximately 1,400 miles every day, stopping at a new location. We had several Methodist churches that hosted us, usually provided us a meal and a meeting with the community. And we also had a little app called Warm Showers that is a collective of bicyclists that if you agree to let bicyclists come to your house and stay, in return, they'll let you stay at their house. That's where we stayed most of the time. And the idea behind it is just like the walks and the runs. When we stay with a community, we meet with that community and we talk about Leonard Peltier and give them information on what that case is about, and in turn they tell us what's going on in their community, and we just carry all that information with us. So a lot of people refer to it as like that pebble that gets thrown into the water. It might not seem that it means a lot right there, but it's as it spreads out, that information keeps going and going and going.
How did the people you spoke to respond?
Well, I mean, most of them responded the way most people respond, which is, I can't believe I've never heard of this. And then we showed the documentary several times, the incident at Oglala, the Leonard Peltier story. And hopefully after that, you know, because we also give out the information on what they can do to, you know, ask the president for clemency, which is to write the White House, call the White House hotline, and now tweet, because that seems to get anyone's attention nowadays, including the president's. So hopefully they felt passionate enough by the time we got done talking to everybody that they went out and did those things. Because that's the only way that we're ever going to seem free, is that if enough people will follow through.
If people haven't heard of Leonard Peltier's case, what do you tell them?
The thing with the Peltier case that is important to me is that Leonard did not get a fair trial. And all of that information is there through the Freedom of Information Act. And I believe that if he would have received a fair trial, then he would have been free. He wouldn't be sitting in a prison right now. And that's the thing that I try to stress with people. If you've seen the documentaries and you've read the books, if you have a conscience of any kind, you cannot say that he received a fair trial. He deserves one, and he should receive one. And then when he does receive that, he'll be free.
So, Jim Torin, what happened when you got to Pine Ridge?
Every year they have what they call the Oglala Commemoration. Commemoration is on the day of the actual shootout, which is June 26th. The first night we rode our bikes in, and we had a nice little grill out with the community. They showed us around the property. They've got some nice memorial plaques out there now for Joe Stuntz, who was killed during the shootout, and for Leonard, of course. And then the next morning, there was a youth run from Camp Freedom to the little cemetery, and then a big group of people walked with an honor drum in front. They were singing songs in front, and then we walked behind the truck for approximately 2 miles. And then they had speakers that came, people that were actually there, and then afterwards they fed the community. People haven't forgot. We just need more of them.
I have an Indigenous friend who posted to Facebook that if Trump hates the FBI so much, then he should grant clemency to Leonard, since it's the FBI that has always adamantly opposed his release. So what can people do to support him?
If you want current information on what to do for Leonard, then you should go to whoisleonardpeltier.info, and that's his website for the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, and you'll find all the information on how to donate, which is very important because lawyers aren't cheap. You'll be able to find out where all the information on what you can do on letter writing campaigns, and those are upcoming, directed directly at the president. Most importantly, send Leonard a letter because he appreciates them. It lets him know that people are still supporting him.
That was Jim Torin, founder of the group Footprints for Peace. Learn more about the campaign to free Leonard Peltier and Indigenous activist groups by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WXOJ in Northampton, Massachusetts, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Using Los Niños for a wall. The wail of babies rips like a knife through millions of hearts. Children, scared, alone, torn from their mothers, weep and wail as their families try to enter Fortress America. Families are split asunder as the security states of America handcuff parents and encage children. Decades of demonization of Hispanic immigrants, now married to the hyperbole of a presidential campaign born in criminalization of Mexicans, has led to this chilling, unholy moment. It could lead to nowhere else. Campaigns that trade in fear can only lead to tears. For a foolish, madcap wall, now being used as a bargaining chip, children and infants are reduced to tears. None of us should be surprised. This is the cold face of politics, a politics based on fear of the other, fear of brown faces, fear of an emerging youthful community, while Americans face a declining birth rate and an opioid-addicted suicide rate that surpasses the nation's murder rate. The anxieties of the old causes fear and tears in the hearts of children. We need to tear down France's gift, the Statue of Liberty. It no longer fits the nation we live in, a nation bathed in fear, raised on racist hatreds, truly deserves a wall where their hearts are already shielded behind brick, steel, and barbed wire fences. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Of the August 8, 1978 police attack on MOVE in Philadelphia. From that day to less than a week ago, Debbie has been in a cell serving out an outrageous 30 to 100 year prison sentence, one of seven surviving MOVE members. And like other MOVE members, she served 10 years over her minimum term before release on parole. Upon her release, in comments published by The Guardian of London, she remarked on two MOVE sisters who were not granted parole, Janine and Janet Africa. Debbie said, "Having to leave them was hard. I was torn up inside because, of course, I want to come home, but I want them to come with me. I was in shock when it didn't happen that way." When Debbie was first arrested, she was 8 months pregnant, and in September 1978, she gave birth to a healthy baby boy, Michael Africa Jr. Fed by her sisters, who smuggled food from the mess hall, she spent 3 days with her son before it was discovered she gave birth
when the two were immediately separated. Mike Jr. tells of the first night living with his mother. He knocked on her bedroom door, and when she told him to come in, she was standing there barefoot. He looked down at her feet and realized it was the first time in his life that he had seen his mother's feet. His friend Benny told him that two-year-old babies and infants knew more about their mothers than he, a man almost 40 years old. But the story is Debbie Africa, after 40 years behind bars, is free. May freedom come swiftly for the rest of the MOVE survivors of August 8, 1978. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Outcome. Antoine Rose Jr. was in a car stopped in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania recently by local police, and Rose, a 17-year-old, followed his instinct and ran away. A cop at the scene, Michael Rosfeld, pulls his service weapon and shoots 1, 2, 3 shots, and Rose is gone. 3 shots, 3 hits, 1 death. Rose, unarmed, had no weapon and posed no threat. Rosfeld, on his first day on the job as a cop, may have worked his last as the local prosecutor charged him with murder. And now, a 17-year-old boy has breathed his last and, by death, joined scores of youth killed by cops, Oscar Grant, Rakia Boyd, Mike Brown, Tamir Rice, Alan Bluford, and beyond. East Pittsburgh has exploded into protests over what happened to Rose. Once again, death comes by cops, but because of video phones and social media, we see it and resistance grows. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour Summer Series. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs broadcast produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation, in partnership with the Center for Research on Globalization. Our shows air on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States, and our podcast at the website globalresearch.ca. This week, we are airing part of a Winnipeg presentation by Professor Julia Buxton on the topic, Venezuela, Was Another World Possible? For the 2017 Geopolitical Economy Research Group Conference at the University of Manitoba. The conference was timed with the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution and therefore chose to explore revolutions as a theme. The rise of Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution that Rise had inspired provides a crucial case study for discussion. Venezuela underwent a period of radical transformation with the turn of the 21st century, inspiring a wave of regional progressive left governments coming to power across the Latin American region. Julia Buxton notes, however, that amid the redistribution of the political, economic, and cultural power within Venezuela, dysfunction and contradictions began to emerge during Chavez's third and final term and entering into the first term of his successor, Nicolás Maduro. Buxton's keynote lays out a great deal of the historical development from before Chavez's election in 1998 to the current period and expresses hope mixed with pessimism about Venezuela's revolutionary aims and objectives surviving the repression, regression, and corruption so close to the core of the state apparatus. Julia Buxton is professor of comparative politics at Central European University's School of Public Policy and senior research associate at the Global Drug Policy Observatory at Swansea University. She is a specialist on Latin America and an expert on Venezuela, receiving her PhD from the London School of Economics, where she also studied for her MA with distinction in comparative politics. The talk we are about to hear was recorded by videographer Paul S. Graham. Here is Julia Buxton speaking on Sunday, October 1st, 2017 at the University of Manitoba in the Schultz Theatre at St. John's College.
So my journey in Venezuela then began in the early 1990s when I had just finished my master's at the London School of Economics, and my work was very much focusing on the role of trade unions in democratization processes. And I was comparing Latin America with Eastern Europe. And when I thought about doing a PhD, I was particularly keen to look at Mexico, because at that point in time, early 1990s, Mexico was the place to be doing really radical, innovative research, and particularly in terms of understanding the pushback against neoliberalism. And my PhD supervisor said, I don't want you to go to Mexico. If you want to do a PhD with me, I think you should go to Venezuela. Which was quite a heartbreaking thing to hear at the time when you feel all radical and activist, because Venezuela was something of an unknown quantity. And it's also quite a difficult country to study because of the oil economy and the rentier dynamics of the state. But nevertheless, under his very strong urging, and I do mention this because I think sometimes the way we go academically and intellectually is influenced by people who we don't really acknowledge enough in our work. So I went to Venezuela. I was given the intense methodological advice by my supervisor, and for any of you who are working in academia, methodology, as you know, whether you're quantitative or qualitative, and the advice that I got from my advisor, who was a very elite Oxbridge-educated gentleman in a safari suit, was the approach I want you to take is FOFO. Is anybody here familiar with FOFO? Essentially, FOFO means fuck off and find out. And that was why I was sent to Venezuela with the FOFO approach in mind. And Venezuela was interesting at this point in time because in 1989 there had been a horrific experience in Venezuela, and this was called the Caracazo of February 1989. And during this period, there was a major popular demonstration uprising against a neoliberal economic package that was introduced by former President Carlos Andrés Pérez, who's pictured down here at the bottom of the screen. And this popular rebellion was brutally and violently suppressed by the Venezuelan state, and particularly through the deployment of the Venezuelan armed forces. And that, in turn, triggered a rebellion within the armed forces from the junior ranks, who thought this was absolutely outrageous that the proud Bolivarian military forces had been used to suppress their own people. And this really is the beginning of the political career of Hugo Chavez, who you see at the top there in the picture with the other leaders of the attempted coup in 1992. Now, the coup failed, and Chavez went to prison. But what you will probably be aware of is that Chavez then really began to unravel through this coup attempt this system which was known as Vene Democracia. Very briefly, because Sunday morning at 9:30 is not really the time for going through Venezuela's recent history, Venezuela was very late in coming to democracy. It wasn't until 1958 that the country moved away from military dictatorship here under Juan Vicente Gómez. And so Venezuela had a pacted transition. And in this respect, we have the emergence of two dominant parties. It was a dominant two-party system. Some of the academic analysts refer to this as partidocracia. And this was Acción Democrática, or AD, and COPE, which is the Christian Democrat Party. And in 1958, these two bitter rivals put aside their differences and, through a pact, agreed that essentially they would share power. And this power-sharing agreement brought into it the military, the church, the private sector, represented through an organization called Fede Camaras, and also the trade union movement. So this was, in effect, the creation of a very clientelistic framework of politics. So it was only through the official unions that you would be recognized as a worker, and it was only through the official private sector organization, Fede Camaras, that you were able to access government and political representation. This is all very important because it really kind of links to my full circle argument on Venezuela. Now, the way that these two parties, AD and COPE, stabilized Venezuela was that they essentially shared power. They shared appointments in the judiciary, they shared appointments in the electoral administration, they shared effectively positions in the state bureaucracy. So this was a power-sharing agreement. Now, this enabled Venezuela to avoid the catastrophic right-wing military interventions that we saw in countries such as Argentina and Uruguay and Brazil. And Venezuela had what we call a positive sum gain. And this was enabled by its oil export revenues. Because the oil export revenues flowing out of, coming into Venezuela from its oil exports was then distributed through the Venezuelan state to the parties and to their affiliated unions and organizations. So this created a positive sum gain. There was no class conflict in the way we would understand occurred in places like Brazil and Argentina. But then this began to unravel dramatically in the 1980s and in the early 1990s for a whole host of reasons, but in particular, and this is again the full circle argument, reliance on oil export revenues. And the problem was during periods of boom economic prices, Venezuela was known as the Saudi Arabia of Latin America. It was one of the fastest growing economies in the world, massive reductions in poverty and inequality, but then oil bust. And when the price of oil exports diminished, Venezuela was left in a very, very difficult financial situation. And the way the parties sought to manage this, and this links to Kiss's keynote the other day, was through this kind of creation of a welfare state as a way of ameliorating political and class conflict. But to keep this model going, they borrowed money from overseas. So Venezuela became increasingly indebted, producing ultimately a major debt crisis by the early 1990s. Now, this gentleman down here, Carlos Andrés Pérez, he sought to deal with this through a process that I called Perestroika, because what Pérez sought to do was liberalise the economy, this kind of very neoliberal approach, but at the same time, and as a way of trying to reduce popular protest, he also opened up the political system. So he made it possible for minor parties to compete. There was processes of decentralisation and processes of attempted political reform. So when I arrived in Venezuela, the country was in crisis, but there was a real breakdown of the traditional political system. Carlos Andrés Pérez himself was impeached, Chávez was in prison, and what we had was a scenario that was wide open for the emergence of non-traditional populist figures. And when I arrived in Venezuela, that non-traditional populist figure, who everybody was looking to save Venezuela, was a beauty queen. And that beauty queen was Irene Sáez. Irene Sáez had been Miss Universe, which is the inevitable qualification for holding presidential office in Venezuela. She had this, you know, wide popular appeal, so everybody was looking to Irene. Now, I had this choice of either looking at a beauty queen, she was mayor of Chacao, but by the time, you know, we can talk about looking at beauty queens in the Q&A, but I actually was more interested in what was happening on the left. And in Venezuela, I became particularly drawn to an organization that was called La Causa R. And La Causa R, which had been formed by a gentleman called Alfredo Maniero, who's photographed there, had developed this theory. It moved itself away from the traditional Venezuelan left, the socialist left, which was represented by the MAS party, the movement to socialism. And Maniero's argument that was that due to the underdevelopment of the working class, because of the overwhelmingly informal nature of Venezuela, because of the specifics of Venedemocracia, there needed to be an alternative route to social change. And I emphasize social change. And the whole theory and position of La Causa R was to focus on mobilization in three key sectors. First of all, these three pillars, three legs of the stool, as Maniero called it, first of all was the attempt to build independent trade union organization. So union organization that was separate from the Punto Fijo Venedemocracia trade unions. And the focus, really, of this activity was down in Bolívar State, in the south of Venezuela, which was the center of the heavy industrial drive of the 1970s. The other main locus was the intellectuals, and the focus here was largely in Caracas. And this was about trying to change the cultural dominance of what was seen as being Yankee imperialism. Of Venezuela. So it's trying to engage in intellectuals and trying to present alternative visions of Venezuela's culture and identity and history from that which had been presented by the Punto Fijo system. And then the final leg here was the popular sectors, the massive, sprawling, informal economies. And you see this picture here. This really, I think, is emblematic of the distinctions in Venezuelan society between, on the one side of the highway, the wealthy and the privileged, and then on the other side of the highway, these mass sprawling barrios of Venezuela. And this is where La Causa Aérea sought to mobilize. And it ran in the presidential elections, but it faced really serious challenges. Electoral fraud, and this is why looking at fraud, electoral fraud was so important to me, but also high levels of repression by the Venezuelan state, and particularly down in Bolívar. André Velasque ran, who was the candidate for La Causa Aérea, ran for the presidency in 1993, but was really quite roundly defeated in what looked like, to my mind, one of the most fraudulent elections that Venezuela had had in the modern period. Now, going back then was that Velasquez had been essentially sidelined because of this electoral defeat, and you had this radiant, beautiful, blonde-haired, blue-eyed former Miss Universe who was taking the country by storm. And then out of nowhere, and literally, I mean out of nowhere, we had the emergence of this former leader of the coup attempt of 1992, which was Hugo Chavez after his release from prison. Now, Chavez mobilized with an organization, his Movimiento Quinta República, which was the Fifth Republican Movement. And what was interesting about Chavez is that he had a profound skepticism of civilian political organizations. And in particular, Chavez's skepticism related to what he saw as having been the failure of La Causa Aérea to mobilize in support of the coup attempt of 1992. So for Chavez and for Chavez's supporters in the military, central to their vision was the notion of the military having a leading role as the driving force of revolutionary change, and the perception that civilian organizations were utterly unreliable and spent all of their time arguing about left-wing positions in meeting rooms. Chavez wanted action. So Chavez mobilized around Quinta República and had this tremendous success in the presidential elections of 1998. I was in Venezuela for the British government as an election observer, and it was an extraordinary experience to see all of these votes coming in for Chavez. And when it was very clear that Chavez had won, Sáez, the beauty queen, kind of killed her election campaign at the end, because as Chavez rose up, she became increasingly right-wing and neoliberal and tried to look for agreements with Aedi and Copé. And then, arguably the most fatal aspect of her campaign, when asked who one of her heroes or role models was, she said, Margaret Thatcher. However, Chavez was citing his hero as Tony Blair. So, Chavez steams through these elections as Irini Sáez collapses. And what we have then is the movement towards this new phase of Venezuelan history, which is the effort to deconstruct the Fourth Republic and build the Fifth Republic. Now, this is where I think we need to pay a little bit of attention to who was influencing Hugo Chavez, because what we're seeing currently from both the political left and the political right is, in my view, this effort to rewrite Venezuelan history and to rewrite Chavez. And in particular, from both left and right, we have this idea that Chavez was, since the emergence of his political career, a committed Marxist. I completely disagree. It's very difficult. And what prompted me with this conference, I went back and was reading some of these original interviews with Chavez, with people like Farruko Sesto, who were around Chavez at the time. And you really are struck by the emphasis and the influence of Latin American thinkers and writers, and also European, but European kind of mainstream democratic socialist thinkers. So I would say that when Chavez first came to power in 1999, the kinds of main intellectual influences that we see for Chavez was, first of all, Simón Bolívar, the leader of the Venezuelan independence movement, who had also liberated other countries in the region, Bolivia, Ecuador. And Bolivar's arguments in the mid-19th century was that these new countries of Latin America had to unify and defend themselves against not the Spanish and not the rampaging imperialist Brits, but instead against this new emerging power to the north called the United States. So for Bolivar, there had to be regional integration to defend the independence of Latin America. So Bolivarianism, and what Richard Gott in his wonderful book on Chavez, The Liberator, has detailed, is the influence of Bolivar and of Bolivar's own teacher, Simon Rodriguez, and also the independence leaders of Venezuela, Zamora, and all these kind of very traditional historical leaders of Venezuelan independence and nationalism movements. I would say that the other key influence on Chavez was Juan Velasco Alvarado of Peru. He was the leader of the military coup attempt in Peru in the late 1960s. And in particular, Chavez was drawn to the Peruvian military model because unlike the right-wing militaries of Chile and Argentina, the Peruvian military saw themselves as key actors in national development. And this was profoundly influential for Chavez and his Bolivarian vision that the military had the key role in national reconstruction. Eduardo Galeano was also profoundly important, as later was Chomsky. You may have seen images of Chavez waving around Galeano's open veins of Latin America and this engagement with the historical dependency and exploitation of Latin American countries by the imperial powers. And then also Anthony Giddens and the notion of a new model of third-way socialism. So there was Tony Blair in there, there was a Tony Giddens in there, there was Simon Bolivar. Chavez was a real intellectual magpie. But the key thing is that the emphasis was not on Marxism, it wasn't on socialism, it was about building the Fifth Republic and deconstructing the Fourth Republic, the 1958 Punto Fijo model. So what we have then is this immediate first phase from around 1999 where the focus is on the following. Firstly, the overriding centrality of constitutional reform. A constituent assembly was convened. There was a redrafting of the Venezuelan constitution, which was released and approved by popular referendum in 2000. There was an emphasis on participatory, or what they call protagonistic democracy, because the Punto Fijo system had marginalized and excluded and controlled popular participation. What the Bolivarian Revolution wanted to do was to build a new protagonistic model in which emphasis was instead placed not on the formal liberal institutions of the liberal democratic model, but a more Rousseauian vision of direct democracy, of community control, of community councils. So we had politics and institutions and a reconfiguring of the institutions. Every arm of the state was dominated by Acción Democrática and COPEI. So they rebuilt the judiciary. They created a new judiciary, the TSJ, the Supreme Justice Tribunal. The old Electoral Commission was reframed, rebuilt. It became the CNE, the National Election Commission. National Assembly was created out of the old Congress and Senate. The old Senate was sidelined, dissolved, and we had a National Assembly. So there was a major institutional reconfiguration. Now, the other thing that was central in terms of the Constitution and these early initiatives was also an emphasis on social policy. And here, and we see in the 2000 Constitution, new social rights written into the Constitution of the Bolivarian state. And in particular, what we were looking at here were programs that were intended to overcome the chronic inequalities, structural inequalities, marginalization and exclusion of Venezuelan society. So there's an emphasis here on the role and responsibility of the state in education provision, in health provision, in housing provision. The social economy, and again, very much influenced here for Chavez by the notion of a kind of third way, moving in and rectifying the failures of the market, there was a strong emphasis on the importance of oil sovereignty, that the Venezuelan state had lost control of its hydrocarbon resources. And this essentially followed a strategy of privatization in the state oil company PDVSA, which had been pursued in the late 80s and early 1990s under the neoliberal structural adjustment process. And as a result of this opening up and privatization of Venezuela, the view of the new Bolivarian government, the ideas of people like Bernard Momma, of Ali Rodriguez, who had been very influential in the Causa Aérea, bringing the ideas of people historically like Salvador de la Plata about state ownership of hydrocarbon resources. So there was a big push to reverse the privatization and to nationalize the oil sector. And under the new constitution and under legislation that was developed by the National Assembly, the Venezuelan state had to have a maximum 51% share in any oil-related exploration activities. And linked with this, and in terms of foreign policy, the aim was to try and drive up the international oil price. And crucial to mention here is that when Chavez came to power, Venezuela was essentially producing oil at a loss. Venezuela has very dirty, heavy crude oil. It's enormously expensive to drill, and it's very difficult to refine. And it trades below the global oil price basket. But the emphasis now was trying to drive and lift up this oil price through aligning with other hawks in OPEC, such as Iran, and then trying to ensure that once you control your oil sector, you can actually maximise the revenues of your oil economy. So this was a complete repudiation of the idea that commodity-dependent countries had to actually diversify and sell or give away, privatise their natural resources. What Chavez was saying here was that we need to have sovereignty over our oil resources, but, and crucially, we do need to diversify. And we can actually use these oil revenues to effectively stimulate national development across the country. And then the final aspect here, foreign policy. Venezuela, through this model and ideas of Bolivarianism, looked to regional integration, but integration not on the basis of these competitive race-to-the-bottom free trade agreements, but instead around the ideas of collaboration and sharing each other's comparative advantage. Building new institutions, moving away from this terrible regional organisation called the Organisation of American States, which is simply there to be the kind of puppet of US foreign policy, to move and promote South-South development, linking up countries in the global South, and also to build a multipolar vision of the world order. So to completely move away from the unipolar dominance of the United States. So I would call this phase one of the Bolivarian Revolution. And this was really, to my mind, a progressive, broad coalition. And in particular here, you also see the military coming into politics. But the reality of this first phase of the Bolivarian Revolution is that there was very little social initiative. Okay, there wasn't a huge pro-poor agenda. The emphasis was on institutional and constitutional redesign. If we don't control the judiciary and the National Election Council, we're just going to be simply overthrown from within. So this was the primary focus. But then we move to a far more dramatic phase. And this dramatic phase is 2002, when we have the coup attempt against Hugo Chavez. This extraordinary moment in Venezuela led to, for 48 hours, this interim right-wing junta led by Pedro Carmona, who had been the president of FEDECAMARAS, which was the private sector organisation that had previously been part of the formal Punto Fijo state structures. Now, this was a really interesting moment, and we can talk about this in the Q&A, but for the UK, which was, you know, everybody talks about the US being involved in this, but the British government was very much involved in this, and particularly Tony Blair, which was a shame given how much Chavez appeared to like him at the time. And we had this very embarrassing moment, as we tend to do being British, where one of our foreign ministers, a gentleman called Dennis McShane, who was subsequently sent to prison for corruption, appeared on television and said, "I'm really glad to see that Hugo Chavez has been overthrown. I never liked the fella." And then 48 hours later, Chavez was back. And Chavez was back overwhelmingly because of the mobilisation of popular sectors. And there's a wonderful film that I'm sure many of you have seen called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, when the Irish film company RTE, who had gone to interview Chavez, found themselves then trapped in the presidential palace when it was the coup attempt. So if you haven't seen The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, I strongly recommend it. So the experience of the coup attempt transformed the Bolivarian Revolution in my mind. And I would say that we actually moved from the Bolivarian Revolution to Chavismo. And this is Chavez, if you read the words of Federico Sesto, Chavez hated the term Chavismo. Because he didn't want this revolution to be about him. But I think what we see during this phase is growing popular identification. Clearly there was before, but I would say that Chavez, as the kind of central glue in this process of transformation, really becomes essential at this point. And what we see from this point onwards, whereas Chavez and, you know, during the first phase, they've been a bit relaxed, constitutional reform, institutional reform, this was now a real revolutionary process. And it was aided and facilitated by the fact that the regional and the international environment was beginning to change. So in particular here, what we were beginning to see during the second phase was firstly a lift in the international oil price, which was of course connected to the fact that the United States was very distracted with its war on terror, instability in the Middle East, the oil price is rising. This means Venezuela has a real increase in revenues coming into the state, which can then be distributed into a range of initiatives, social policy initiatives, to consolidate the popular sector and really address these issues of inequality. The other key thing was there was major anti-US sentiment in the region at the time, most of the time, really, obviously. But at this particular time, linked to efforts to push through the free trade area of the Americas. But also, and absolutely centrally here, you had the beginnings of the pink tide. So Chavez was no longer on his own. He now found himself with, you know, regional sympathisers and sympathisers, such as Kirchner in Argentina, Lula in Brazil, which was hugely, hugely important. And then this coalition of progressive left forces. Correa was elected in Ecuador and Evo Morales in Bolivia. So Venezuela is no longer operating, unlike today, in a deeply hostile regional environment. And this enabled major traction on key institution-building initiatives. And I would also say that during this phase, Chavez becomes personally closer to Fidel Castro, and Venezuela becomes bilaterally closer to Cuba. And in particular here, as we'll see in a second, this is the beginning of the oil for doctors exchange programs. This is where Chavez, who had seen Fidel Castro as a mentor previously, but this is where this relationship becomes very, very tight, very close and very important, and where you have this increased emphasis on the necessity of the civilian military defense of the revolution. So this is a real shift.
My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Today, as part of our summer series, we're airing a talk at the University of Manitoba by Professor Julia Buxton on the topic of Venezuela, Was Another World Possible? This keynote address was part of the university's Geopolitical Economy Research Group Conference, held in the fall of 2017. Here is more of that discussion.
So in terms of these domestic initiatives, you're probably familiar with these, most famously the Misiones. This was a major social policy drive. It encompassed programs such as Barrio Adentro, going into the neighborhood to deliver primary and secondary health care in situ to communities which previously weren't wealthy enough to afford private health care in America, and because the public health care provision in Venezuela was so utterly diabolical. So Barrio Adentro, community health provision. There was an extension of citizenship rights. The 4 million plus Colombians who had fled to Venezuela as a result of the civil conflict in their country were given citizenship, given identity cards. There was a drive to ensure that all Venezuelans had identity cards and therefore they had access to these programs and access to voting rights. There was a shift from the old tick the box, put your thumbprint on voting system towards automated electronic voting. And all of these range of policies here, which were initiatives in education, healthcare, Bolivarian schools. It was about breakfast clubs. It was about employment programs. It was about literacy training. This was an immense period in Venezuela. And crucially, there was an emphasis on gender and recognizing that you had to be gender sensitive in your programs. It was about creating the Women's Bank, Ban Mujer, to enable women and also popular sectors who had no access previously to credit to be able to borrow and develop their own social and community networks and enterprises. Crucially, and this is really quite fatal, the decision is also taken to what Chavez calls turning off the spigots, oil taps, to Venezuela's traditional elite, economic elite. very powerful five economic families who, because of the rentier nature of Venezuela's oil economy, had in effect become this domestic economic oligarchy. And the decision was taken, and Steve Elner has written extensively on this, and I strongly recommend Steve Elner's work to you, is that the Venezuelan government decided it would have to create a new loyal economic elite to drive forward the diversification of Venezuela. And this is, I would argue, the point where things start to go slightly wrong. But the key thing here is we have a mass redistribution, not just distribution, redistribution. This is very important differentiation of Venezuela's oil wealth. And also, as you can see here, this in turn impacts on inequality and poverty levels in Venezuela. I wrote a paper for the UN at the time because what was interesting was that other countries were experimenting with models of what we call CCT, conditional cash transfers, places like Brazil and Mexico with Solidaridad y Progreso. And the idea of these conditional cash transfers is that if you give money, welfare payments, to the community on the basis of them fulfilling certain requirements, taking your child to school, getting inoculated against measles. And what was astonishing about what Venezuela did was to say, actually, just CCTs is totally inadequate. There's no point having this very, very small payment if you live in a situation of chronic insecurity, if you have inadequate housing, if you don't have access to enough calories, if you can't afford to buy food, and if you haven't got an education. So actually, you've got to go further than CCTs. You've got to completely reconstruct the basic social services system. And this really was an important lesson learned for development. And I think that this was a crucial phase for Venezuela. Similarly, there was a big push now to create what was called a new geometry of power, in particular influenced by the late and much lamented Doreen Massey. And this is the idea of creating and emphasising the role of communities as the key locus of decision making. And it was for communities to decide what their key water needs were, for example, through water committees that brought together the community and the state. It was there for communities to decide what were the health needs they required through the Barrio Adentro programmes. We had a mass programme of land redistribution, which was intended to enable the diversification of the economy and a reduction of Venezuela's food dependence on imports. But there was also a big push to transform the culture of the country. And in particular here, going back to what I was saying before, it was a move to recognise the indigenous identity of Venezuela, the Afro-Caribbean, Afro-Venezuelan identity, which had always been sidelined because of this big emphasis and linkage with the United States and what was seen as being this baseball Yankee culture. If you're interested in this period and this kind of cultural revolution, I strongly recommend the work of people like Naomi Schiller and Sujata Fernandez. On the regional front, major progress here, facilitated by the oil revenues. ALBA, the Bolivarian Alliance for the American Peoples, which brought together countries such as Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, the Caribbean countries, Ecuador. Instead of, competing in the international economy against each other, this was about comparative advantage. If you need oil and I need flour, I'll give you oil for flour. If you need sugar, you need concrete, then we'll exchange. So this was about building a system of exchange. We also had the UNASUR organization, which was built as an alternative to the Organization of American States, excluded America, excluded Canada. And we also had initiatives such as Petro Caribe, where Venezuela here was aiming to distribute discounted oil to Caribbean and Central American countries, which were really crippled by this major surge in international oil prices. So this, again, was about building regional solidarities. And then because one of the perennial problems of our time is Fox News and CNN, as part of these efforts to transform the way Venezuela was portrayed externally, we have the launch of initiatives such as Telesur. International level, pushing during this phase to build a multipolar world order, major initiatives around South-South integration, really reaching out. Chavez was very active on issues around Palestine and Palestinian conflict between Israel and Palestine, very, very sympathetic, really prioritized Palestine as being a key issue for the Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution. Peace in Colombia. Chavez was instrumental in the peace process that today is coming off the rails in Colombia. Total rejection of the role of the United Nations in things like Haiti's Blue Helmets, the UN peacekeeping mission in Haiti led by Brazil. Why are we sending in Brazilian Blue Helmets to rebuild Haiti? Just give Haiti the facilities to rebuild itself. Okay, so really challenging the international order and the model of global governance. Building relations within OPEC, as I mentioned before, and with NOPEC countries, those countries not in OPEC, Algeria, Russia, Vietnam, again then tying up the South-South integration initiatives. And then hydrocarbon distribution programs, using oil as a tool of petro-diplomacy. In particular, after the coup attempt against Chavez, Chavez decided that because Mr. Bush was so concerned about poverty in Venezuela, Chavez was very concerned about poverty in the United States. So Chavez, through Citgo, set up this oil distribution program with discounted heating fuel going to First Nation communities and also to geriatric communities, homes for the elderly. And also, and interestingly, and this links to Jorge's presentation the other day, the use of union attachés in Venezuela's embassies around the world. So really promoting cultural and labour integration. No idea who that fella is in that middle picture, Alan, do you know? The Mayor of London, ladies and gentlemen, the Mayor of London. and the exchange programme between Venezuela and the UK. Then, to really accelerate now, we go into a third phase. And this is when Chavez decides that Venezuela is going to start striving to build socialism of the 21st century. And this came as a bit of a surprise to very many people. You can go through all of the writings, and even if you're looking at Greg Wilpert, Mike Gonzalez, Diane Raby, the lack of definition over what is socialism of the 21st century, I think, has been one of the most problematic aspects of the Bolivarian Revolution. But nevertheless, Venezuela was striving for the socialism of the 21st century during Chavez's third presidential term in 2006. Very loosely articulated, and again, we'll come back to this in the Q&A, but there was a real shift here, a real kind of move towards the embrace of more arguments around needing to control the economy and have a higher role for the state in Venezuela's economy. Oil is now seen as being the motor of the revolution. Why would we diversify when actually we should be using oil as the key driver, the real way that we mobilize our domestic and international influence? So you have a process here of accelerated nationalizations. Instead of focusing only on the popular sectors, Chavez began to embrace something he hadn't really been very fond of, trade unions, building a trade union organisation. Huge nationalisation programme with expropriation really being led from the grassroots. And you also had during this period the creation of the new Socialist Party, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, and a big, what was seen at that time, as anti-corruption drive. So that was the third phase, and before we actually had any real idea of what socialism of the 21st century was going to be, unfortunately, Chavez died in 2013. And again, another surprising twist, his former foreign minister, Nicolás Maduro, assumes the presidency. And this is really where I think we have to be realistic about what Maduro inherited. Firstly, he inherited a catastrophically deepened dependence on oil export. Venezuela, during Chavez's government, went from relying on oil exports for about 75% of its revenues to around 92% of its revenues. What Maduro also inherited was an escalating foreign debt, which today stands at around $134 billion. What he also inherited was a very distorted economic policy. During the coup attempt of 2002, price and exchange controls had been imposed in order to reduce capital flight and to try and ensure there was distribution of food to the populous sectors, but they were retained right through. And this is the argument of people like Mark Weisbrot. There was a failure to adjust these basic tools of the macro economy. And this started to create big distortions, most particularly in the distribution of dollars. There was the official dollar exchange rate, And there was also the unofficial dollar, the black market. And those who had access to dollars were the most privileged in Venezuela. It was those with political connections. And this became, I would say, the key driver of the staggering corruption we have unfortunately seen unfurl in Venezuela. There was also a crisis of violence and insecurity. Venezuela, if you look at the UN today, in terms of homicides, is probably around the world's third most dangerous place because of its homicide levels. You cannot have a functioning participatory democracy if you can't go out in the dark. Okay, so this was a real neglect of popular security. The PSUV was very fractious after Chavez's death, and I would argue this was because in reality there have been very limited opportunities within the ruling party and the broader coalition for proper discussion and debate. And I would say in particular the almost unilateral decision to move towards socialism of the 21st century led to a hemorrhaging out of the from the party of those kind of social democratic left Chavistas. So we see this big kind of shift. The grassroots become increasingly disaffected. There's a lot of lack of real clarity over what now is the meaning of the Bolivarian Revolution, but also the perception increasingly that unless you are politically connected to the PSUV, you don't have access to dollars, you don't have access to food distribution programs. The opposition was strengthened, I'll come to them in a second, but also the other problem, and this is what I discussed in the New Left Review article, was that the misiones and all of these amazing social policy initiatives simply weren't institutionalized. What Venezuela essentially developed during this period was a parallel state. The old state wasn't dissolved and removed, it was retained. At the same time, these informal structures were built. So there was these two systems running side by side. And the real problem here, and particularly with, for example, the misiones, is, I would argue, an emphasis on quantity of provision rather than the quality of provision. There was no monitoring and evaluation. There was no proper data collection. When you're concerned about poverty and development, I'm afraid these things are important and they do matter. And the external environment was changing for Maduro. The pink tide has receded. We've seen the right wing re-elected in Brazil, in Argentina. And catastrophically, as we all know, the oil price has dropped. So I don't want to dwell on the statistics, but you can really see here the problem that Venezuela is facing now. Catastrophic fall in its GDP, horrendous fall in its oil exports, running a major budget deficit, and is facing catastrophic payments on its international debt. And this is a whole debate in itself. Should Venezuela be paying its international debt? Because what Venezuela has been doing is faithfully and loyally repaying exorbitant yields, interest rates, on its sovereign debt. Venezuela has a catastrophic, in my view, debt repayment coming up at the end of this month. Between the last week of October and the first week of November, it has nearly $3 billion in debt repayment to make. In the context of an international reserve position of around $8 billion. And the way Venezuela has been making these payments has been squeezing dramatically the consumption in the country. I hold my hand up. I also work with people through political risk. And believe me, right now, the people who most want to see Maduro stay in power are holders of Venezuela's sovereign bonds. Because the Venezuelan opposition have said if they take power, they will restructure and renegotiate the debt. That's not what international bondholders want. The reserve position has collapsed, and we have this roaring situation of inflation. Unofficial estimates now is that inflation is running at about 1,660%. We can say it's economic warfare. I've had the economic warfare argument since 1999. Economic pressures are really quite catastrophic. Huge increase in the black market value of the Bolivar. So really, this situation now is benefiting the locationally advantaged over the locationally disadvantaged. Access is increasingly predicated on political connection. And then, as you can see here, just this constant fall. And what were in the oil price? And this is, to me, the travesty of somebody who's, you know, was so enthused about what was going on during this period, this second phase, when I did believe another world was possible, and Venezuela did present this model of alternative, transformative social change. Is that what we're seeing is a reversal, complete erosion of all of the gains that were made during this phase in the mid-2000s. Poverty is up, inequality is up, and these are, for me, extremely serious concerns which are simply not being addressed by government economic policy. And to give you one example of what I see as the utter stasis of policy in Venezuela is that Venezuela has retained a massive subsidy on the domestic distribution of oil, of petroleum. Huge. The price of a litre of petroleum in Venezuela, as I'm sure you know, is cheaper than a litre of water. Who benefits from this massive subsidy? People who have very big cars. Who has very big cars? It's not the popular classes. I think that the retention of this oil subsidy is one of the most regressive distribution systems in Venezuela, and it is extraordinary to me that this has not been addressed by the government. The argument is, in 1989, when we lifted oil prices, it caused the Caracazo. I simply don't buy the argument. This economic situation required that this subsidy had to be addressed. But overwhelmingly, I would say, the most calamitous situation for Venezuela right now is its relationship with China. China has emerged as being the key lender for Venezuela. Venezuela's debt to China now is in the region of $63 billion. China-Venezuela's relations, to my mind, is a mortgaging out of Venezuela's future. Now, we can all put our hands up and say, well, you know, we didn't want US exploitation, we didn't want commercial exploitation by US transnationals. All I can see right now is that has simply been exchanged by exploitation by Chinese private companies and Chinese public companies. This situation for Venezuela and the terms of the lending to Venezuela have been ruinous. Venezuela essentially negotiated its debts and lending to China at a time when the price of oil was very high. In exchange for lending, Venezuela ships oil to China. Because of the fall in the oil price, Venezuela is now having to ship three times the amount to China of its oil than had been originally agreed with China under this initial 2006 Chinese loan package. Venezuela is entirely, right now, economically dependent on China. And to read headlines like this, whether it's the National Interest, whether it's the Guardian, whether it's the Telegraph, whether it's the National Enquirer, is astonishing. This is not Bolivarian sovereignty. Should China allow the revolution to fail? Very quickly, and we'll come back to this. 2 seconds, 2 minutes? I mean, no, it's Q&A. This clock's wrong, isn't it? The counter-revolution, completely to be anticipated, obviously to be anticipated. At least the United States has been consistent in its hostility. It doesn't matter whether you're Madeleine Albright, who refused to meet Chavez in 1997 before he was the president, or whether you're Donald Trump. The US has been remarkably consistent. Whether you're Democrat or Republican, what we have seen for Venezuela is the effort to contain what I believe was initially the threat of a good example. And we've seen this through the influence of the anti-Castro lobby, increasingly now Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, who has moved into the vacuum of any Trump appointments, really, to the State Department. And when you're actually yearning for appointments to be made in the US State Department, that's how dire the situation really is right now in global politics. So the Beltway Network is very important. People who were previously in the Venezuelan government, went to Harvard, went to US universities, now work in American think tanks, very, very influential, privileged access to US government. And then some of the issues we've also talked about in some of our workshops, the channeling of resources to the opposition through the NED and USAID. And if you're interested in this, obviously read Ava Gollinger, whose book The Chavez Code details line by line the money that has been channeled to the opposition. A particular concern is that the whole discourse around human rights, these liberal normative values, has been used against Venezuela. Human Rights Watch, very, very early on, has been very, very critical and harsh on Venezuela, which has really kind of devalued, I think, the whole normative human rights narrative. And we've also seen Venezuela decertified for failure to comply in the war on terror and the war on drugs. And now we have a situation where individuals in Venezuela are being sanctioned. The only saving grace is that the opposition in Venezuela are completely useless. And never has there been an opposition movement that probably was so useless in the history of Latin America than the Venezuelan opposition movement. Totally divided, completely hapless. totally counterproductive interventions. And I would actually argue, and in the article I'm currently writing, really you have to understand Chavismo and the hegemony of Chavismo as a default of the failures of Venezuela's opposition. Complete shifts in its strategies, boycotts, strikes, lockouts, just a permanent cycle of strategies to undermine the Venezuelan government, but which simply fail to connect to ordinary Venezuelans. And in particular here, fake news. Okay, I would argue the Venezuelan opposition movement were the pioneers of fake news. And you can be sat in Russia, you can be sat in Iran, you can be sat in Europe, and you'll be reading, and this really began, you know, during the opposition protests 3 years ago, led by Leopoldo López, where you were seeing all of these images. You see here this image on this side here, and this is saying that, you know, this is repression of the people of Venezuela by the Venezuelan armed forces. Unfortunately, if you do a photo image search, you'll actually see that it's a picture from Argentina. Similarly, SOS Venezuela, repression, repression, and a picture of students being dragged away, but actually the picture is from Chile. Similarly here, awful Venezuelan police kick dogs. Okay. Actually, no, it's a picture from Greece, where they clearly go around kicking dogs a lot more than they do in Venezuela. And then down here, the, you know, collapse and decline of the healthcare services. Look at these babies. We have Barrio Dentro. This was an astonishing program. And look, now you've got babies in baskets. It's a photograph from Honduras. Sadly and unfortunately, so many of these images regurgitated by the mainstream news. But the big thing here is that the opposition have no popular connection. And going back to the keynote we had on the first day, when Keith was talking about counter-revolution as representing popular aspiration, Venezuela's opposition represent no aspiration of the popular sectors, and I discuss this in my article in NACLA. So finally, my constructively two-minute critical perspective. We have enormous benefits to learn from what happened in Venezuela. This was a real beacon of progressive change. It was a landmark period, transformative impact and provider of rights that have never previously been acknowledged on the continent, very important in terms of pushing back the neoliberal agenda, and really created for the first time in Latin America after coups and interventions the idea another world was possible. But here's the problems: utter ideological flux and incoherence. If you're going to nationalise everything in the economy, can you afford it? And who runs it? Is it the workers or is it the state? That was never decided. Continued under-theorisation of the state itself, overly reliant and commodity-driven. What Venezuela has actually created is a new elite, the so-called bully bourgeoisie, who are those people who have benefited from the distribution of these illicit subsidised dollars. Massive policy dysfunction, as I think I mentioned before, retention of regressive subsidies, and when you're going to go around nationalising Venezuela now has 562 state-owned enterprises, but you don't have the money to invest in them, that results in electricity shortages, water shortages, blackouts and power failures. And you have no money for capital reinvestment and find yourself in international arbitration. Politically, no institutionalisation of initiatives, corruption as an ongoing problem. This parallelism, as I pointed out, community councils really never gained the traction that was necessary or vital, constantly in conflict with the ruling PSUV. And I would say at the heart of policy dysfunction has been the constant turning over of ministerial offices. If you want to know why Venezuela has such outrageous levels of crime and violence, in my view, it was because during 15 years, 13 years of the Chavez presidency, we had 11 different interior ministers. You really cannot get policy going in that context. And no M&E, as I was talking, monitoring evaluation. And I think the biggest tragedy is this lack of space for dissent and critical discussion. There is now a very high reliance on the role of the military in maintaining the government in power. The military hold key positions in the government. They hold key positions in the economy. They have their own radio station, their own investment arm. But I think the real problem for the Venezuelan revolution, the Bolivarian revolution, is that it missed two important things. Generational change. Okay? It's now nearly 20 years since Chavez was elected, and there's a whole new generation of young people who've come through who don't remember the old Punto Fijo period, or the salience of the Bolivarian revolution. And the other aspect here is the influence of the diaspora, hugely underestimated by the government, profoundly influential overseas. And my final two points, and I end this... I think that if you are to have a process of revolutionary change, the rule of law does matter. I just don't find it helpful that Venezuela has recreated a judicial system, but really there is no functioning rule of law in the country. And in particular, I would argue that Venezuela and its opposition have frozen the country. And important progress in important areas of rights have been completely bypassed. Venezuela is so far behind the curve on LGBT rights that it's really ranked up there with some of the most homophobic countries in the world. On issues such as women's rights and gender rights, there has still been no process on the effective legalization of abortion. So as a result of this, one of the leading causes of female mortality in Venezuela is as a result of access to unsafe abortions. I'll leave you with the thought that actually, and I think the way history may judge this, is that tragically the reality is the Fifth Republic was very similar to the Fourth Republic. And just as the Fifth Republic had its Petro Caribe, the Fourth Republic had the San Jose oil exchange. There was Tercer Mundismo under Carlos Andrés Pérez. The FARC always had an unofficial embassy in Venezuela before Chavez even came to power. And there's always been close relations with Iran. So ultimately, I think what we have in Venezuela is just a return, sadly and unfortunately, to the zero-sum game. And I'm going to run now before you all start getting really cross and angry with me, but that is unfortunately where I would have to conclude. And I'm sorry to overrun.
That was a talk by Julia Buxton, professor of comparative politics at Central European University's School of Public Policy and senior research associate at the Global Drug Policy Observatory at Swansea University. Speaking on the topic of Venezuela, was another world possible? The talk was presented at the University of Manitoba on October 1, 2017, as part of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group's Revolutions Conference. The video of this presentation, along with videos of other speeches at the conference, are available from the group's website at geopoliticaleconomy.org. The audio of the talk was recorded by videographer Paul S. Graham. Music was by Purple Planet Music. More selections are available at the site www.purple-planet.com. The Global Research News Hour will return next week with more special summer programming. My name is Michael Welch.